They're millions, all right, McGinnis. Millions of people being lied to, taken for suckers. You know, it's a funny thing. They have pure food and drug laws to keep people from buying poison to put in their stomachs. And you're peddling poison to put in their minds. Call Senator Walter, Lorraine. He's at the Wardman Park.
Look, I tell you what, you come with us and I'll split everything right down the middle. And I'm not talking about any lousy $20,000 or $30,000 a year salary either. Your kind of public relations are peanuts. But with us, we turn the screws on the United States Congress, and from there it's just a step to the White House. With our people, we can't miss. Can't you see that?
Yes, I can see, all right. I can see what you and your phony front groups are manufacturing. You're manufacturing fear in order to sell your peace at any price campaign. It is not going to be very difficult for the senator to find out just who is paying the bills. I'm beginning to see how big the puppet is growing and who is pulling the strings.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's a minute past 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 5th of December 2025, streaming live from a corner of freedom close by Bristol City Centre, near Junction 3, as a matter of fact. Don't believe a word we say. That's how we like to start this show, but we do try to share some moments of clarity from Bristol's Templar Port. I mean, we're not really quite like Sky and The Sun and the BBC that propose, or UK column, that say that they're telling you the truth. No, because we don't patronise people like that. All we're saying is that here's a load of interesting stuff. We've done our best, but don't take it as read that this is all 100% true. That's your job, is to actually discern partly. Because if you outsource that decision to the mainstream press, you're going to end up going over a rather nasty cliff. Likely. Anyway, so we're in Bristol's Templar Port, turned a merchant venturer fiefdom in the city of London's UK empire of lies. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at djplugradio.co.uk in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, on holylandradio.com between 11 a.m. and 2:30 p.m. Central Time, 87.7 FM if you're in West Sweden, Wisconsin, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, which is great. Get it for Christmas. It's free. Available from GitHub, APK Pure, an old version of it, apparently, but also the Apple App Store is still on there, but not by the evil Google Play. So if you've got an Android phone, go to GitHub or go to the show page at thisweek.org.uk with the link to where to get the app from. And it works pretty well. I've been using it myself for quite a while now, listening in the car during the week. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its zero trust agenda, bending our minds with Orwellian BBC Verify, which only sometimes gets things right. What are they playing at with that? Or boring us to tears with vacuous celebrities, puff pieces on the conspirators, and hatchet jobs on the heroes. McCarthyite witch hunts, particularly that within the Labour Party, going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity and against the rentiers and the World War III and the genocidaires and the rentiers who create the wage slaves. We'll be hearing maybe a little bit from Martin, because he's been having trouble with his housing over this last week or so. So for those with eyes to see and ears to hear the so-called solutions to these crises, housing, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, prisons, farming, cost of living, their twisted accelerationist solutions are crafted to make every crisis worse, in case you haven't noticed. So it's not the end of the world, though. Or is it? Anyway, helping us navigate the World Economic Forum's Fourth Reich here in Bristol, Britain, and around the world, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also joining us in the studio today is former Labour councillor here in Bristol, Harriet Bradley. We'll be hearing this week from Oliver Tickell, who's he's a former editor of the Ecologist magazine. So he's one of the people that built the green movement up. But then, of course, when it started to go pro-nuclear, etc., they elbowed him out from editing the Ecologist. So he's a sort of old-school green, I suppose you'd say. We'll be hearing also about the sad death of David Lear, the filmmaker in London, with an obituary from him, a part of it anyway, from one of his fellow campaigners, stood outside Pentonville prison doing vigils for those inside on hunger strike for Gaza. That's Steve Headley. So Iranian and Russian news cancelled here in the UK by the telecoms cartel and Ofcom, us off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, and also from People's Republic of Stokes Croft by the trans lobby, but not cancelled off of here yet. Anyway, I'm very pleased to welcome Harriet Bradley. It's not so often that we have councillors, but you're an ex-councillor, aren't you?
I am indeed an ex-councillor. I was chucked out of the Labour Party, one of the many, on some kind of false charge.
So are you looking at Nigel Farage this week? They're saying he's an anti-Semite, and he was saying things when he was aged 14 at school in South East London back in 1975 that make him an anti-Semite.
He is a real anti-Semite, I think. He's certainly a racist of the first water, isn't he? What a man. What a man.
Martin, what are your thoughts about this whole idea of anti-Semitism being used against people? Because it's not... I mean, I thought it was something that just happened on the left. I'm looking at this as an uncorroborated accusation against him. Maybe it's true, but it's not been tested in court. There's been no libel case or anything, and it's from 50 years ago. But Nigel's an anti-Semite.
Well, he is an anti-Semite.
Would you like to say why he's an anti-Semite?
Yeah. Because when he was people have testified, if he doesn't like it, he can sue.
These people can be sued. Your evidence hasn't been tested either.
No. Is somebody going to sue me? I haven't said anything yet.
No, they're not going to sue. Not even the Labour Party. So why is it that you haven't been thrown out of the Labour Party, but Harriet has?
Because I keep my head down.
I'm a bit of a wild woman, so I don't keep my head down. I speak the truth to power.
Good, well done. Well, sorry. Anyway, can you just explain maybe a bit about how you came into becoming a Labour councillor here in Bristol and then what's happened more recently?
Right, surely. I've been in and out of the Labour Party all my life. I think I first joined it as a student at about 21, and I've had all sorts of roles within it. I'd left because of some awful thing they did.
Can you just tell us what you were doing when you were a councillor and how long you were a councillor for?
I was a councillor for Brislington West for 3 years. And I rejoined the Labour Party because of Jeremy Corbyn. And I was known in Brislington.
Were you ejected from the Labour Party before that, or did you leave?
No, I left before.
Why?
Because I didn't like it, ending Clause 4. I didn't like its education policies. I kept disagreeing with it. But when Corbyn was standing, I saw a chance for the Labour Party to regain its true nature as the party of the working class and the oppressed.
OK, so before we hear about what you did when you were a councillor, what do you make of what happened to Jeremy Corbyn? Because a lot of people were pinning their hopes on him.
They were indeed, and we had huge rallies here in Bristol, if you can remember.
Well, he was like a rock star, I remember.
He was a rock star, yes. And I was a very keen supporter. A lot of people say that the fault was that he wasn't strong enough. I think, sort of looking back, he probably did make mistakes, but he was very inexperienced when he came into the leadership. And I think he relied too much on the bureaucrats. As we found out, the bureaucrats in the Labour Party are not a very nice lot of people. They basically appear to want to dominate policy, and one fears that they're partly responsible for the Labour Party's lurch to the right.
So that's not the only party that has problems like that. I know I experienced this within George Galloway's party, which I joined for a short while, and then I found that actually there was a small group of people around the General Secretary, Paul Cannon, Tim Pendry, various other people who are very much behind the scenes, but they control the party, who are basically like a little clique, and that anyone that points out things like, hang on, you're sharing far-right material here, they are considered to be the enemy. And so George is really, he's amazing in himself, but that party, I compare to Farage's party. Farage's party is going places. George is being held back by his own bureaucracy.
Yes, and this has happened to the Labour Party under Corbyn. These people actually organised for him to lose the 2019 election.
Is there any evidence for that, really?
Well, there's plenty of evidence that I've seen in terms of tweets and things that these people said to each other. And, then you have people like dear Peter Mandelson, who said he organised against Corbyn every day. Oh. And, so Corbyn didn't really stand a chance. And we've also got to take into account the media. The media in Britain is far right. It lies all the time, but unfortunately it influences people's views. And so people thought that there was things... They thought that Jeremy Corbyn might be an anti-Semite because he had been accused of that, for example.
Right. What about in Bristol, the regional media? Because that's supposed to be a little bit easier to get the truth out through there and actually working, rather than the London press is quite controlled.
Yes, I think the Bristol press is a bit better. I haven't been reading it, though. I get all my news now from Twitter.
So what did they do to you, the Labour Party?
Well, they accused me of anti-Semitism.
For what?
For tweets that I'd written.
About?
The thing that really did for me was attacking the Labour Friends of Israel. Well, and why, I would continue to do that, because the Labour Friends of Israel are responsible for lobbying and allowing the genocide in Gaza to go on.
Well, some would say, Martin, some would say the Labour Friends of Israel are actually working directly for the Israeli government and the Israeli intelligence services.
Well, we don't know who funds them, because it's opaque, but it's pretty clear because of the Al Jazeera sting that was carried out, if you remember, Shai Mossad, who's basically a Mossad guy.
He was a political attaché.
Political attaché.
Israeli embassy.
That's right, and he said, well, I've got £1 million to spend to get the Labour Party in the line that we wanted to, and Joan, whatever her second name was, who was in the sting, said, yes, that's what we want to do. And she, of course, resigned from the Labour Party at one stage because it was too anti-Semitic, and now she's back. The Labour Friends of Israel are pro-Zionist and therefore pro-genocide.
Absolutely, and that's why I was against them. And they, of course, were also very much against Jeremy Corbyn. So that was my reason for my admittedly foolish tweet. But I wasn't finally... got rid of for that. I finally got chucked out because I gave a talk outside the Labour headquarters, which was run by the Jewish Voice for Labour, which is the good Jewish people. and we were. It was a kind of witch hunt. A lot of famous people was there. Natalie Wimborne, I think, who's one of the leaders of that movement. And we were all talking about, you know, this false accusations against people like Jackie Walker and many good lefty people.
Jackie Walker is... what she said was that the Jews were behind the slave trade.
She may have been right, I don't know. I don't want to get into that kind of backward anti-Semitism. I'm only focused on what's happening now and what has happened in Palestine since the Nakba.
Right. And what about your role as a councillor? How did you find that? What were you actually up to? Because it's quite a lot of, I think it's in it, something like £3 or £4 million a year is being spent by Bristol City Council on our behalf.
Yes, well, I enjoyed being a councillor. I didn't like full council because it was full of party games playing. But I enjoyed being representing my constituents in Brislington. Very nice people they were. And I also enjoyed being on the planning committee and trying to stop bad developments, which was my main interest. So it was good. But, you know, I didn't like... I have to say, can I be personal? I wasn't very fond of the mayor, and the mayor wasn't very fond of me.
Okay, so lots of people have talked about Marvin Rees, yes. When he was the mayor. I think one of, if not the first black mayor in Britain. I mean, it's really your job to be supporting somebody.
I voted for him, but I found out that he didn't really have much idea about how a council should work. And so he set himself up as a man who would take all the decisions. One thing that was really annoying was the decision about where to put the... what's it called? The
arena?
The arena, oh, yes. Yeah. Because the people in Brislington were passionate for to be on the Arena Island, as it used to be called, because it would bring business into Brislington. This is actually
in central Bristol. It's very close to Temple Mead Station, yes. Which is actually on the road to Brislington, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So they had a good reason for it.
But they decided to build it up at Filton Airfield, the old closed Filton Airfield. And by the way, they still haven't started building it now.
I know.
So what was all this about? Well,
it was a mess up. It was a stitch up.
Where every now and again I go past there, and I look out the car and I think, has anything actually started here yet? And the Brabazon hangar, which is where they're supposed to be building it. Nothing.
Yeah, I know.
So anyway, surely Marvin is going to listen to somebody like you, isn't he? I mean, you know, although he's a Labour mayor, he's making his own decisions. He's going to be listening to his councillors.
He did listen sometimes. He actually asked my opinion about airport expansion. And I said I was all against it because I was already becoming very keen on climate activism, which is what I did when I quit the Labour Party. And I had a talk with him and explained why, and he did listen to be fair to Marvin, but then he went and voted for the expansion anyway, because he said it would bring jobs. What kind of jobs?
But what about the system now? There's no longer a mayor in Bristol. We voted to get rid of a mayor.
We've got
the Green Party, and we've got a council leader rather than a mayor. What's the difference, and is it any better?
I am a member of the Green Party. I'm also a member of your party. I'm glad to say that you're now allowed to dual membership. No, we voted at the conference. I was elected by Sortition, and we voted that dual.
So, did you go to this conference last weekend?
I couldn't because I wasn't very well.
And so you're on Zoom or something.
Yeah.
So tell us why that decision has been made, that people can be in your party. This is Jeremy Corbyn and Zara Sultana's new party and other parties too.
Well, it's quite a complicated issue, I have to say. One issue is that the SWP and Counterfire are very strong.
Socialist Workers Party.
Yes, and Counterfire are very strong, and they wanted, obviously, to continue to be in SWP Counterfire and also to be in your party. But on the other side, I was part of something called the Democratic Bloc, which wanted it so that if there were progressive parties, such as the Greens under Zach Polanski, there was a possibility of an alliance and a negotiation. And that's what I'm in favour of.
Well, hang on, you can have an alliance and a negotiation with a separate party without people actually in both parties.
But I might want to be in both to influence the direction of them both.
Mm. Martin, what do you make of this idea of, say, I mean, could you be a Conservative and a Labour member?
No, you couldn't be that.
Could you be a Your Party and a Conservative?
No, you couldn't.
So is there only a certain list of parties that you're allowed to be a member of?
Yes, that's right. There will be a list. It hasn't been drawn
communist?
Up yet.
Can you be a Communist be a Party member?
Probably.
Ah, right, okay. But this is a bit of a controversy, Martin. Can you explain why, being in two parties at once?
Obviously, there's a kind of realignment going on the left. There's the rump Labour Party, which has got running the government, and they've got lots of Labour backbenchers there who are not necessarily happy with the direction of travel. You've got the Workers' Party, as you mentioned earlier. You've got the Green Party. You've also got the SNP, Plaid Cymru, Sinn Féin. In actual fact, we need a change in the electoral system. The main failure...
Come on, you've just gone off the subject completely there. What I'm asking is, what is the point of allowing somebody to be a member of another party whilst in your party?
That is a matter for your party, which I'm not a member. I'm just talking about what Corbyn did wrong. I just want to make this point.
Oh, right, we're going back to that. All right.
When he spoke in Bristol, I got down there first. I asked the first question. I said, in New Zealand, the left wing of the Labour Party forced a referendum on PR through knocking on doors. They didn't try and change the leadership of the Labour Party. They went straight to change the electoral system. This was just the New Zealand rugby team were revolutionising rugby union. And, of course, that what Corbyn could and should have done. He said, yes. I'm in favour of proportional representation, and then you're going to pull the whole left in behind that. But he didn't want to do that. He wanted to have a first past the post election where Labour wins with a minority of the vote, and then we're going to force it all through. Yeah, I'll bet you he's in favour of PR now.
Yes, he is.
Of course he is. And he should have been in favour of PR then, you know, and then we could have got the ball at the other end of the pitch.
I'll answer the question myself about being in various different political parties at the same time. Is that there is a whole track record, particularly on the left, of infiltration of parties and overturning of parties by big blocks within parties. So you don't necessarily want, say, for example, the Socialist Workers Party recruiting everyone it possibly can to join the Labour Party to influence policy, because actually that's the SWP's policy. It's not Labour policy or your party policy, Harriet.
Yes, well, there's a fight that will still continue. But I think for the most people who will take advantage of this, that the dual membership would be those good organisations that Martin listed, such as Plaid Cymru, and which has gone very left at the moment and looking to go for independence for Wales, which I'm all in favour of. I have a Welsh husband.
Well, does that mean we have to pay a toll on the bridge?
Yes.
Maybe they want us in there, because if you are anywhere near the Seven Bridges of an evening around about 5-6 o'clock, you'll see a massive rush hour. Yes. Going west because of the cheaper house prices.
Yes,
in
they all
places like Newport.
Live in Newport. Lots of people I know live in Newport.
Yeah, and they just
come into Bristol to work.
Exactly, yeah. Just like a London style rush hour, actually, yeah. Across the bridges. But that's because it's so expensive to live here. Maybe they quite like having people coming over to Wales and spending money, but we shall see. So, anyway, look, talking about your party, great rally last weekend. Lots of things were going on. But let's have a listen to not Jeremy Corbyn, but Zara Sultana now, who gave quite an interesting speech there. I think she's a former Labour MP, and I think it's probably fair to say that she's a fiery, sparky inspiration. Bear in mind that she has said that she doesn't want anybody in this new party that doesn't support the transgender lobby. But let's just set that aside for a minute, because have a listen to what she's got to say on other matters.
In this room and everyone outside of this room knows what's wrong with Britain. Nothing works and nothing gets better. This country is rigged to serve the rich and powerful who bought and paid for it. And we plan on beating them before they lead us into fascism to protect their own wealth and power. Our diagnosis is simple. In the last 20 years, mega donations to political parties from the rich haven't just doubled, they haven't just trebled, they have gone up sevenfold. When prices go up on your weekly shop, supermarket bosses are pocketing that and then buying politicians. When your rent soar, landlords use your cash to lobby MPs so their interests are protected. When the seas rise and our towns flood, energy bosses buy another private jet while we all pay the price. The billionaires buy up our newspapers, our social media platforms, our TV channels to gaslighting us into blaming our neighbours for the mess. They want you angry, just not at them. Our message to our friends and our neighbours is, if you want to know why your life is getting harder and why everything keeps getting worse, know that the people who control your food, your home, your energy and your media, they are sending billions of your hard-earned money to the Cayman Islands, and they've got three political parties, Labour, the Conservatives and Reform, all sewn up. So you work harder, for longer, for less. While politicians take money from poor kids and pensioners, everything gets difficult, so offshore bank accounts get fatter. The only thing that none of these old parties will ever say, that there is enough room for everyone in this country, except for the rentiers who own Britain and charge us just for living in it. They are the real parasites, and it's about time they got taken off and taken down. Weak and pathetic Labour government that is pushed this way and that way with the political winds because it does not have the political will to confront the parasites who own Britain. We are here to break up a system that humiliates our disabled friends and neighbours and deprives them of the cash that they need while funneling an extra £11 billion a year to arms companies. That's right. Keir Starmer wants an extra £11 billion on defence every year, and all the old parties back it. £350 of our money every second on war. That's money into the pockets of shareholders for the merchants of death. After 2 years where our money has funded daily spy flights over the ruins of Gaza, aiding and abetting a genocide. This is a Labour government happy to oppress people abroad and at home. This isn't a coincidence. The politicians who attack the disabled in Liverpool and demonise the desperate arriving on small boats, they are the same people who blow up our world with war, occupation and genocide. But we know that the real enemy of the working class travels by private jet, not migrant dinghy. So it's not about stopping the boats, it's about stopping the private jets. Ordinary humans suffer everywhere so the mighty and powerful can sleep in silk sheets in their blood-soaked mansions. And as socialists, we stand with the oppressed everywhere, from Sudan to Congo to Palestine. And let me say this loudly and proudly, I am an anti-Zionist, and if we fight for it, your party will be an anti-Zionist party.
So there goes Zahra Sultana, Free Free Palestine. I suppose that's the sort of thing you like to hear, Harriet, as she's really... I mean, I love her little thing where she says, don't stop the boats, stop the private jets. I mean, this is just the opposite of people like the Tories and Farage. And obviously, the people who are in those private jets are privileged, wealthy. Quite possibly, they could have had the meeting that they've had in their private jet on Zoom anyway. And so it's an interesting tack she's taking there, and a pretty forceful one.
Yes, well, I think she's very good. She definitely inspires the younger generation, as does Zach Polanski. I think the problem about Jeremy now, as you know, I was a great supporter of Jeremy, but I think he's kind of a bit old now, and the people who flock round him are really the old Labour rejects like myself. So I think that I would really like to see an alliance between Zach Polanski and Zahra. I think they speak the same language, and both are very attractive to young people. I went to the talk given by Zach Polanski quite recently in Bristol, and it was interesting that, unlike most left meetings, the people there were mainly young people, which was very heartening. And the reason I'm in the Green Party is that I'm a climate activist, which I'm hoping you're going to ask me about soon.
Well, go on.
Okay.
Tell us all about it. I mean, with climate, my own attitude to it is, yes, there is climate change, but this whole idea of bringing nuclear power stations is a disaster. It's an environmental nightmare. Mm. And that's what seems to be the solution. But I mean, I know the Greens have in Scotland, where they had power. I don't think they have any more of the Scottish Greens, but they voted and brought around the extension of the life of nuclear power stations. So it seems to me there's a whole sort of agenda here to say, well, we're going to get rid of coal, but nuclear is better. And there's
I'm against nuclear. I'm in favour of wind. And we're doing a lot on wind, but of course, unfortunately, the cost of new wind farms is being put on.
You've got to have something a bit more beefy than a windmill in order to run the country. You've got to, I mean, this is what coal and gas used to provide.
Solar panels as well. I mean, if you look at places like China, which have massively invested in green technology, they're actually doing very well in terms of producing power. I mean, if you look at China, what's happening there is quite extraordinary. It's the opposite of what's happening in Britain. This infrastructure is totally amazing, and and people are not moaning and complaining.
Well, it's lovely to go on about solar panels.
I won't talk about China.
Well, no, it's fine. Admires China. And in fact, in a way, China is doing what the British Empire was doing, building all the industry for the world.
It's true. A
couple of hundred years ago. Now it's all happening in China.
It is indeed. And not all to the good either. I talk about my solar panels, climate activism?
Solar panels. Yeah. Before we get off solar panels, they're building them all over the countryside now, aren't they?
Yes.
They're not interested really in growing crops so much as apparently the farmers, they don't have to do anything and they can make two or three times the amount of money just by putting a bunch of solar panels on their land. But that means that they're not making food. We have to import the food instead.
Well, the reason that they're not making food is a lot to do with the climate. We've had the three worst harvests in living history in the last five, in records, in the last 5 years, and we haven't produced enough grain to make bread for the population, so we've had to import. So the thing is, the climate isn't just about power, it's about a whole lot of things.
I'm trying to steer around to talk about farming, because farming is the sort of the bedrock of everything, really.
Yes, farming is very important.
If you haven't got a surplus of food, then suddenly things start to go horribly wrong.
We're going to have to focus on farming, because food is going to be absolutely crucial in the next 10 to 20 years.
Last week's budget, up in central London, there was a whole load of farmers who were told around about 5 o'clock the day before, even though whilst they were travelling to London, no, you're not allowed to bring a tractor to London. But most of them just came anyway. And so there was quite a big protest outside the budget about farming. We heard a little bit about that last week. We're going to hear a little bit more now from farmers who we can hear from you afterwards what you make of their complaints about this inheritance tax that Rachel Reeves brought in last year and is going to be implemented next April.
Well, they're moving us off here with the Section 14. I don't know where they're going to send us now, down to the embankment probably. I don't know, they're getting a bit umpty with us.
I farm in Andover in Hampshire. We're about 600 acres and I'm a mixed farm, so I produce store cattle and arable crops. We've come up to London today, obviously budget day, to show our dismay at the government and with the ongoing inheritance tax issues. As it is proposed at the minute, my children will have to pay a vast amount of money to buy their own farm back. We travelled up late last night and got into London about 1:30 this morning and didn't know anything about it till we were stopped by police officers and said the demonstration isn't going ahead. You're not permitted to park your tractors in London. Luckily enough, we managed to get parked up off the road and we stayed in our tractors all night. We've been warned that if we don't move on, we may possibly be arrested. Why it's been cancelled, I do not know. I can only presume that there's going to be some ultra bad news in the budget this afternoon, and the powers that be in the city didn't want hordes of farmers with heavy machinery in the city.
All I can tell you, sir, is that a senior police officer stated that if there were to be tractors down Whitehall or anywhere else other than Richmond Terrace, there would be serious disruption to members of the public.
Yeah, but it's just a peaceful protest.
Yeah,
you know. No one's causing anything.
Yeah, no, and I'm not saying that
most
it's not
of these
peaceful.
People have never been arrested before. Yeah, I'm sure they haven't.
We're here trying to save our livelihoods from inheritance tax and everything else, because at the end of the day, all these farmers have given up. Some of them left yesterday lunchtime in Cornwall, and it's just a disgrace how this government are treating the farmers. If they don't look out to the farmers, that this we're going to starve in this country. We need everyone to just buy English at the end of the day.
The police have just overreacted, unfortunately. You know, a lot of people have just come down and brought their tractors anyway, because we've got a right to protest. We got permission from the Met Police to park on Whitehall like we did last time when we had to visit London before, and have a peaceful demonstration, a show of numbers, and just tell the government that we haven't gone away.
My name's Joseph Harper. I come from Worcestershire. My family's farmed on the River Severn just north of the city for three generations, but my family's been farming back as far as records go. If nothing changes and the current legislation goes through, it will ruin small to medium-sized family farms. The tax bills associated with even small farms are crippling for what is already a very degraded, dying industry in this country.
So there's a bunch of farmers. There's more up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Even more farmers talking about it. None of them there, Harry, even mentioned the fact that many of their, almost all of the farmers, apart from the ones that are just, say, for example, livestock farmers, well, they don't really have to do so much. The animals are out there munching away on the grass, and they don't have to. But other sorts of farmers, most other sorts of, they're paying much, much more now for things like electricity, gas, and other inputs for feed, double the price. But the supermarkets aren't putting the price up; they're paying for it. So they're being pushed, and having their assets taken away when they die is actually quite frightening for many of them.
Yes, I agree. I'm very sympathetic to farmers. I watch Country File every week, and there are some really good things that are going on there. So I am sympathetic to them, and I believe that the inheritance tax issue, which was really designed to get sort of big people like Nigel Farage and other people who own great tracts of land, but I think it's been miscalculated, and it will hit these middle and small farms, and that is just not what we want. But can I just say something else? It's very interesting that this protest was stopped, because this is part of the whole movement that I'm fighting at the moment, the end of a right to protest, which is being brought in by all these various policing acts and the Public Order Act and so forth, Section 13, Section 12, Section 14. And I, of course, have just been arrested under Section 13, as you may know, I think, Tony.
So I can see why you've got sympathy with the farmers.
Indeed, yes.
Not only are you munching away on their cereals, and are you a vegetarian?
No,
or
I'm not a
vegetarian.
Okay,
well, you're probably eating a few of their steaks from time to time as well.
Well, not steaks, but I do like their lamb.
And a lamb, oh gosh.
And
yeah.
Their bacon.
Okay, bacon sarnie. But anyway, so what happened to you and what was the context?
Right. Well, I was arrested on November the 24th as part of the Devendar Jury's action in support of Palestine Action, the prescribed organisation, which, as you I'm sure know, a large number of Bristolian people are in jail at the moment, part of the Elbit protests. And
this is the Filton people.
The Filton people,
and in fact,
yes.
Some of them are even on hunger strike.
Oh, yes, and two of them have been hospitalised. They're in such a bad condition. And no reportage of this on the BBC.
Right.
It's shocking.
It's
appalling. So I think Bristolians are rather up in arms. Anyway,
I think if this had happened, Martin, just to bring you in a second, during the IRA hunger strike, you probably have had a massive escalation in the civil war there. If the press is not acknowledging that something like a hunger strike is even going on, this is pretty shocking, isn't it?
Well, it is, and I think the idea of this is punishment through process. That's why they're still in prison. They should have been. They should have been on trial years ago.
They haven't actually.
2 years since they were arrested.
So it's punishment through process.
This is a form of internment.
It is, yes.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, this is totally unacceptable. And of course, the government have dug a hole for themselves, which they can't dig themselves out of. Although the courts may decide to overturn the
ban. Not.
Well, I fear not as well, because they've put three new judges in.
Yes.
Who are all security service related.
And some of them have interest in Israel.
That's right.
Isn't it the early 1980s, the IRA went on hunger strike? That was
That's
a pretty
right.
forceful, and it was covered very well by
the
BBC.
Well, it had to be, because there's so much, it's a different context, obviously, but the hunger strikes are not always the same. You know, there was a hunger strike in Turkey in the 1990s where 14 people died, but I bet you don't remember anything about
it. I seem to remember
media
it,
over
it called H Block. They had a dirty protest and a hunger strike.
That's right. That's right.
So, but it's bizarre that there seems to be an attempt to just keep a lid on the story. That seems to be
well, what they're trying
about.
To do is they're trying to make it as nasty as possible for the people in prison and for others who are supporting them. Mm. And they're hoping that people will just go away. And of course, they're under pressure from the Israelis and the Americans. It's the Israelis and the Americans who said, you've got to do this. And the Labour government just went ahead and did it. And so that's they are basically answering to their masters, who are not here. They are in Tel Aviv and in Washington.
Yeah, indeed. And as Dave, our sound engineer, has just pointed out, at the same time, they're talking about getting rid of jury trials.
Yes, this is absolutely shocking. And Defend Our Juries will continue to fight against this. I should say that Defend Our Juries was set up because Trudy Warner, a social worker, was arrested for sitting out courts with a sign that says the juries have an absolute right to acquit a defendant if they feel that they're convinced of the rightness of the cause. So immediately after Trudy's arrest, she was arrested and taken to the Old Bailey and charged with contempt of court. A lot of other people around the country started sitting with signs, and we had a branch of it here in Bristol. We sat outside the court a lot of times. I don't know if you reported on it when this was happening. That was all sort of peaceful. We weren't arrested or anything. Trudy Warner, her case was dismissed. It was brought by the Solicitor General of the Tory Party, and the Labour Party actually sort of took quite a gentle line on it and didn't force it through, which is good. But since then, the Labour Party has, of course, put its foot down. And
into power, because that was under the Tories.
It was, of course.
Yeah, it's all very well. It's like Yvette Cooper, you know, making all the right noises when she's Home Secretary. And now she's turned into this kind of demonic monster that's just trying to do everything they want.
Well, as you may have read, about over 2,000 people have been arrested as part of this protest in support of Palestine Action for holding the sign that says, "I oppose genocide, I support Palestine Action." I've sat twice in the Parliament Square and wasn't arrested. This was my third sitting, and this time I was arrested. I was outside the Home Office and hauled off to be charged. I haven't been charged, their details have been taken.
Right.
And that's the situation at the moment.
And you're facing what sort of a possible sentence in prison?
Well,
for being a terrorist.
A terrorist, yes. Well, you can get quite a large sentence. I can't remember how many years you can get, but certainly over 2 years.
Yeah.
But it's my first offence, so I imagine I would get a suspended sentence
fine. So they catch you with a machine gun, or was it gelignite?
A bit of cardboard.
Okay.
I mean, it's ridiculous.
It's a bit Python-esque about all this, isn't it?
It is totally mad.
No wonder they're not on the TV at the moment. They'd be having a field day with all this stuff. Let's just focus for a minute on the jury thing, because I've noticed over the last probably 10, 15 years or so that with the arrival of the Supreme Court and the change around of the way that the courts operate in this country, it was always completely normal for somebody to put up a defence in their case saying, "I was trying to prevent a greater crime." This was a completely normal thing, and in fact, not just juries, but even judges were quite sympathetic to this. So, for example, say you see somebody trying to kill someone in the street, and you commit grievous bodily harm against them to stop them killing the other person. That grievous bodily harm is considered to be fine because you're trying to stop a greater crime. And especially, you know, if it's all witnesses are there, you know, it's on CCTV, whatever, it's not a problem. But now they're trying to get, they've got rid of this whole principle. Now, they did it with the climate protesters.
They did indeed.
Roger Hallam was saying, "This is why I did it." He was trying to explain to the jury.
He was chucked out of court.
The judge wouldn't let him. The thing is, he then carried on saying what he was trying to say, and eventually he was done for contempt of court, which is why he got such a long sentence. But in a way, with the Gaza genocide, this is even more serious.
Yes.
So the idea that you can't say that you're doing something, say, for example, destroying a drone, which is going to be used to kill children, you're not allowed to say that in British courts anymore.
It's
so
shocking.
It seems there's an enormous change has taken place.
Yes, I'm afraid we are moving towards an authoritarian police state. And it all seems to me to be coming from Starmer and from David Lammy, who I consider to be a kind of puppet of a lapdog of Starmer. You remember how Prescott was seen to be the sort of lapdog of Tony Blair? It's the same kind of position. And he's extremely a very stupid man, frankly, who makes terrible judgments, but I think they all come from Starmer. And this is a Zionist influence. Unfortunately, like in America, Zionist influences have infiltrated our society to an extent which I think we were totally unaware of.
Well, until because some people will say what you're saying now is anti-Semitic. Have you got any evidence for this being a Zionist plot?
Well, it's a lot of money that has been given to the government by a lot of eminent Zionists. And we've already spoken about the influence of Labour Friends of Israel. I must point out that many Jews have sat, and I'm partly Jewish actually, have sat with the sign. You know, that we can't confuse Jewishness with Zionism. There's a complete divide between many Jewish people who support freedom for the Palestinians and the Zionist dominating the parliament in Israel, so I'm afraid are just inhumane murderers, people like
Martin,
Ben-Gavir.
Is there a Zionist plot, and if so, can you prove it?
Well, there's not just one plot. There's an ongoing campaign of Zionism that's been going on for decades. And, of course, they've heavily infiltrated the intelligence services. Mm. They've heavily infiltrated. So we've often discussed the 9/11 attacks on this show, Tony. You know about the five dancing Israelis which were filming the first plane hitting the towers. They were arrested. It turned out they were working for Mossad. They then were on the television.
Well, this
in
isn't
Israel.
Affecting British jury trials, for example.
All
is
right,
it?
But I'm just talking about.
Let's address what Harriet was saying about a Zionist plot to undermine the sorts of processes that might allow people that destroyed Elbit systems to just get immediately let off and walk the streets again, and maybe go and do something similar again because they've just proved that it's legal and lawful.
Well, they've changed the law because of Zionist pressure. Trevor Chin is a very, very wealthy businessman, and he's very, very associated with the State of Israel. He's given lots of money to lots of members of the Labour cabinet for their own purposes, yeah? So, in other words, there's a direct link between Trevor Chin and the Labour government. Mm.
Well,
okay?
This goes back to what Zahra Sultana's saying about politicians being bought.
Yes.
Well, yes.
And I mean, she's right.
The problem is, all politics requires resources. It does. And the fact is that people with resources are then in a strong position to give the resources to the people they like to get what they want to happen. In the US, the Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court means that any amount of money can be given by anybody to any politician, and you're not even allowed to know what it is. That is absolutely corrupt. Now, our system is moving in that direction. Mm-hmm. And it's always going to be like that, because ultimately you need resources to fight political campaigns. Now, unless the trade unions used to fund the Labour Party, but we've just seen £9 million being given by Harborn to reform, just like that, £9 million. Now, the whole trade union movement can't give that kind of money to the Labour Party, but one guy can give reform £9 million. And that, of course, will then be plastered all over the media.
It sounds like, it's not just the Supreme Court we've borrowed from America, is it?
No. That's not. But you can see there's strong pressure from the Israeli government, that we've had Israeli generals coming back and forth while this has all been going on, you know, in the last 2 and 3 years.
Yeah, well, much of our British system that we've sort of brought up with the thinking was fair, true, the independence of the press, the judiciary and the government, etc. It seems to be being torn up in front of our eyes. And one of the people who's been documenting all that is, I mentioned at the start of the show, is this chap called David Lear, who sadly died a couple of weeks ago, actually at a protest outside Pentonville prison, alongside those people who were talking, they were there to really draw attention to the hunger strikers inside the Filton hunger strikers. So let's have a listen now to Steve Headley. Steve was with him when he died, and was also a fellow campaigner with him. And I just asked Steve earlier this week if he could tell us a little bit about David by way of a tribute. And there is a candlelit vigil tomorrow. That's Saturday, the 6th of December 2025, outside Pentonville, for anyone that knew David, to go along and wish him well, and also, of course, to have a little bit of a to carry on the good work of drawing attention to the hunger strike that's now going on. So let's let Steve Headley say something now about David Lear, who passed away a couple of weeks ago.
As you know, David was a fearless critic of any sort of state authoritarianism and the state's attempt to close down the rights of the free press. And he'd campaigned for Julian Assange before. And the whole absolute debacle around the Filton 24 here, young people who allegedly broke into an Elbit factory and damaged quads, quadcopters and drones that would be used to murder children in Gaza. And then, of course, they were declared terrorists by the prescription of Palestine Action, you know, by the same people, by the same government, you know, the Labour Party, who shamelessly dressed in suffragette colours and even suffragette clothes to commemorate a direct action group like the Suffragettes, who let off bombs, believe it or not, who took a whip to Churchill, who threw themselves in front of horses, chained themselves to railings, smashed windows, damaged property. The same government that was celebrating the suffragettes were now outlawing the modern equivalent of the suffragettes. And me and David shared that outrage of what was going on. As far as we were concerned, and we still are concerned, I'm concerned, these people were doing their duty under international law by doing everything in their power to stop a genocide. And they should be given an awards for them, you know, awards, not imprisoned. And the hunger strikers, they've been brought into prison, they've been maltreated, they've not been given bail after 6 months like everyone else. But most of them are now in over a year. They're having intercepted communications with family. They're not being allowed to see family. One of them has been isolated in the north of England when her family is in London. And we've now got Tuweta Hoxha and Cameron Ahmed, who are both in hospital because of the hunger strike. And this is very, very serious. They're now into the fourth week of the hunger strike. And even if it's resolved, their bodies may never recover because the organs start to eat themselves at this point. They start to take the body to keep the brain alive, starts eating the heart, eating the liver, eating the other organs. So David was there to try to save lives. And, you know, I think that just summed the man up. And he was determined to get justice, not just for the hunger strikers, but to lift the ban on Palestine Action, the ridiculous ban. And of course, for Britain to stop participating in a genocide by giving the Israelis arms.
I mean, one thing, my memories of David is his sense of humour. He would never, ever, even though you're dealing with these really grave matters, never, ever take it too seriously. And that's one thing I loved about the guy. There was a sort of levity about it as well. It was never going to overburden him in terms of, you know, a sort of dark feelings. And yes, yeah, there was that, but it was always a sense of the ridiculousness of it and the absurdity of, yes, some of the claims that are being, yes, made by the authorities. Anyway, there is a candlelit vigil tomorrow, yes, on Saturday for David. That is outside Pentonville Prison, which, if anyone has never been there, is on Caledonian Road in London, and that's at 6 p.m. on Saturday, the 6th of December, 2025. I wonder, you know, that spirit of being at these, witnessing in a way, and that's what David was. He was someone with the camera witnessing what was going on and doing the job. I suppose that we would like to think and hope that all this technology around us, the billions of pounds worth of central mass media, you know, the BBC, ITV, Sky, all these people with their incredible technology, he was able to do it on his own, and he was poking that camera into places that they fear to tread.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I'll just say that the commemoration, that the nearest tube stations are Caledonian Road in Barnsbury, which is on the overground. And the nearest tube was on the Piccadilly line, which is Caledonian Road. It's just one stop from King's Cross. Yeah, but, this was the thing. David, I mean, he had a heart like a lion. If he thought a cause was just, and people were getting oppressed, he was going to go and tell that story. And, you know, all these organisations you mentioned have got all this equipment. The police have got all this surveillance equipment. But, of course, it's what they use it for, what they choose to use it for. And they choose to use it. They uphold the system and they uphold the power structures that exist. And David was totally against that. He wanted a far more egalitarian, far more just world. And he used his camera extremely effectively to expose hypocrisy. You know, when union leaders are crossing picket lines, or the police who are supposed to protect the citizens are carting off old age pensioners for holding up a sign opposing genocide, David was there and defend Julian Assange, his fellow reporter. The man gave months of his life just to the RMT causes and never asked for a penny. You know, the most I would do was buy him something to eat and have a cup of tea. He loved cups of tea. And he was just the most unselfish, lovely person. And I think, you know, I'm not particularly religious myself, but David is from German, Jewish and English heritage. He was raised an atheist, and then he converted to Christianity, became a Christian. And then later on in his life, I believe about a decade ago or some, maybe longer, he converted to Islam. And he never even mentioned that to me. You know, over all the time that I knew him, he never mentioned it. Didn't make it a big issue. But if you think that all the people that make a big thing of their religions, he was the holiest of the lads. You know, he was the person that followed all the three major Abrahamic religions to the letter. And yeah, that was him. An absolutely special man.
So, yes, tributes to David Lear. Tomorrow, Saturday, the 6th of December 2025, outside Pentonville Jail. Quite an amazing chap. And, Harriet, this cause is so important, isn't it? And it's amazing to think that there are people that are prepared, even though they're... In fact, what they're doing is they're watching television. They're saying, well, there's nothing on the TV. So they're picking up the video camera and going out and filming it themselves.
Brilliant, brilliant stuff. Could I read you something from Amnesty, which has just come through my door, which I think is very powerful? The UK is entering dangerous territory. Peaceful protesters are being arrested, 857 in just one day in September 25. Refugees and racialised communities are targeted. Harsh new laws are silencing dissent. This is how authoritarianism begins. Not with ICE agents or soldiers at the door, but with quiet rollbacks of our freedoms. We pause before speaking. We doubt what's true. Rights we once took for granted start to disappear. We've seen these patterns before around the world. Now they're happening here. But remember, protest is a right, not a privilege. That right is being stripped away. The UK government is rolling out new anti-protest laws that give police sweeping powers to restrict and shut down demonstrations, even peaceful ones. And they're calling for us to wake up and do something about it.
Well, there is quite a lot of people being arrested and things like detained. We cannot talk about this really without mentioning George Galloway, because there's this program called The Tucker Carlson Show over in the States, which has become one of the most popular in the whole world. Even though he's been now taken off of Fox News, he's got his own program. And we had George Galloway popping up on the Tucker Carlson Show this week, and Tucker is concerned that when George comes back from some trip abroad, that he's detained at the airport, and the police are insisting that they have access to all of his phone, his computer, and all this sort of thing. Now, back when I was first training to be a journalist back in the 1980s and early 1990s, we were all told explicitly that police cannot do this with journalists. They can't do it with MPs. They can't do it with lawyers unless they've got a very good reason, and they have to go first to a judge to get a court order to put any of these people under surveillance. But now it seems it's normal. So let's have a little listen now to George Galloway on the Tucker Carlson Show, obviously being seen by millions of Americans and people all around the world. But of course, Galloway is virtually banned from the British press.
There's an old First World War truism. We're here because we're here. And ultimately, we'll be here to guard the graves of those that were here because they were here. It's partly that they have dug themselves, I don't want to get Shakespearean, but they are steeped in blood so far that it is a genuine question whether it's bloodier to go on or to go o'er. And they have spent so many hundreds of billions of euros, pounds, dollars of their people's money in a forlorn charge of the Light Brigade, that it's fatal for them politically, to admit that they were wrong, that they misused all those funds and they caused the deaths of all those people for no reason. And so it seems to me it's partly that. Don't forget, Mr. Carlson, these people are at rock bottom in public opinion approval rates. Keir Starmer's currently at 10%. 10%. Only 19% of the people actually voted for him a year ago and a bit ago in the general election. But now it's down to 10. Macron is at 11. Merz is at 18. They couldn't muster a majority if you put them all together. And so what choice do they have? It's continue to reinforce failure, to continue to throw good money after bad, to continue digging, even though they know they're in a hole. So I don't know what choice they really have. The question is, bigger question for me, is why are the media, as they still describe themselves, not holding to account? You mentioned that you first knew me and didn't like me because of my stand on the Iraq war. I was on the BBC every single day in the run-up to the Iraq war, right throughout the war and for many months after. Virtually every single day. I haven't been on the BBC for 10 years. The mass media, as they still call themselves, though, the real mass media is you and exponentially less me, but the people who call themselves the mass media have entirely given up any role that they might have had to hold to account the political leaders for making decisions that are manifestly not working. An American leader said just yesterday, forgive me, I didn't know him, forgotten his name. He said about the European Union's 19 sanctions packages against Russia. He said, well, if you've tried something 19 times, you've got to admit you've failed already. And yet they are currently planning a 20th round of sanctions against Russia. And I didn't properly answer a point you made earlier. These societies, of one of which my own, are not just economically failing. They are culturally and socially disintegrating. Hatred, racial hatred, fear of immigration, large-scale immigration, collapsing birth rates, demographic time bombs. Our societies are the very definition of sick societies. So what are we doing about it? Well, we're sending uncounted and uncountable and untraceable billions to the little chiseling crook in Kiev.
It seems like suicide to me.
Yes, it is. It's self-harm, now headed for suicide. And by the way, it's no accident that amongst the sicknesses in our society is the drive towards state-assisted suicide. Keir Starmer has spent more time in Parliament this parliamentary term piloting a scheme by which you can shuffle your old grandmother off to a pod provided by the state, give her a glass of sherry and put her in the pod and say goodnight. We in Britain have now a 42% abortion rate. Almost every other baby is aborted. And we're shuffling off granny. We have a demographic nightmare. And pornography everywhere. Gambling everywhere. Everybody is sponsored by one gambling. You know, I'm so old, my father used to have to slip a piece of paper on a street corner to a bookie's runner to put a bet, bet on a horse race, and the runner had to literally run in case the police saw him, to a Britain where gambling online, offline, in every high street is practically the only economy we've got.
So this George Galloway, I'll put the full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. What do you make of George, Harriet? He's a sort of old school Labour, isn't he? I mean, maybe like something from the 1970s or even before that. But, you know, he's an extremely good orator. What do you make of the points he's making there about all these to do with the descent of civilization, effectively, and the failure of politics?
Well, I'm afraid I have to agree with George Galloway. I mean, what I see around me, and we haven't talked about very much about the climate, but there has been recently a national emergency meeting chaired by Chris Packham and with a lot of scientific experts, which have really said, look, if we don't do something quickly, we're really up for it. You know, this is the human race is doomed.
But isn't it the US and China that are mostly responsible for causing the trouble?
Well, they may be, but we have to do our bit, don't we? We can't just sit complacently and drive our cars all over the place.
Well, we've got rid of coal-fired power stations. We haven't got a single coal-fired power station left.
Well, that's a good thing, because they're very polluting.
There's plenty in America and China and the rest of the world, but not here.
We have to encourage those countries to do it as well, and we've got to work internationally. But we can at least set an example, and we have to remember...
We've done that.
Well, I don't think we have, actually. I think we've done very little. As I said before, China is better than us on green energy. But anyway, to get back to George Galloway, he is an absolute superb speaker, there's no doubt. And I think he's absolutely right about some of the things that are wrong in Britain. I particularly think this thing about gambling. When you watch telly, all you see is adverts for bingo and enormous prizes being given out. And I just sort of wonder, everybody's struggling, you know, with the cost of living, and we all know the bills are shooting up all the time and are going to shoot up again. And yet people seem to be spending loads of money sort of gambling, and it's sort of desperation, isn't it? I think people are desperate, and this is a way they think they may escape from the difficult situation that they're in. But getting back to what he's saying, you know, the fact that he's been detained in this way is shocking, and that he feels he has to flee the country. I notice on the broadcast, which I listened to, that he said as a result he's developed atrial fibrillation, which I have myself, and it's not a good thing to have, so I felt very sorry for him when he said that. And I was shocked to hear that his wife was also detained, although heaven knows she hasn't done very much, but she got a fingernail painted with the Palestinian colours. And how silly is this, you know, The police again are puppets of the state and the Zionist infiltration. It's very bad too in Germany. In fact, it's worse in Germany than here. But in France, I think we have a balance there, because you do have a very strong.
Well, you know what the answer is conscription. Oh, let's have all the young people joining the army.
Oh yes, and then we'll go to war and we'll get nuked.
That's what they've had this week in Germany and France. Yes. Last week,
I know.
But anyway, just on the police, I just wanted to say something, because I had a very interesting chat with somebody today off the record from one of the housing associations about some. I mean, it's quite clear and obvious now. If you talk to insiders within the world of housing, there's such pressure on housing that what's happening now is criminals are being housed in council estates, etc. So the police have got, like, you know, problems actually putting someone in prison. So the Crown Prosecution Service won't charge somebody because of a mental health issue in the family, even though they're violent criminals or hard drug dealers or whatever. So if there's mental health around arsonists, these sorts of people. So there's a whole load of people out there that the Crown Prosecution are refusing to allow the police to prosecute. And those people are now being inserted into ordinary housing estates all around the country. And this is the sort of thing that the police... I mean, you can't blame the police for it. This is the Crown Prosecution Service doing this, you know, the organisation that Starmer used to head up, who were just saying, no, this is not appropriate for this person to go through the courts. Well, if they're a violent criminal, if they're a hard drug dealer, if they're arsonists, then you can't have them in ordinary housing estates. So this is happening all the time now in Britain, and it's one of the reasons why I think our you know, poorer areas are becoming very difficult and almost impossible to live in. So you know, it would be nice if the senior police can speak up about this. We never hear them speaking up. They just collect their salary and go home. So also, George Galloway mentions pornography there. This is something you don't hear much about, but it's on my book list for this Christmas. I'm going to put that up later on this evening on our show page at thisweek.org.uk with a list of various books for Christmas. If you're interested in buying something now to give to someone at Christmas time, now is a good time to do that. And another one of them is Norman Baker, the former prisons minister, Lib Dem MP. He's got a book all about the royal finances, which is just out as well. So this is going to join that. And the lady is called, oh gosh, what's her name? Jo Bartouche, and her new book is called Pornocracy. Let's have a listen to her now.
A new book has been released uncovering the impacts of pornography and violence behind the multi-billion dollar industry. The author of Pornocracy, Jo Bartouche, joins us next. This is Britain's Newsroom on GB News.
Welcome back. This is Britain's Newsroom with me, Alex Armstrong, and Miriam Gates.
Now, a new book has been released uncovering the dangers and the impact of pornography. The book Pornocracy reveals the violence and misogyny behind the multi-billion dollar industry. And journalist and author of the book, Jo Bartouche, joins us now in the studio. Jo, good morning. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, obviously, this is a very difficult topic to talk about. It's often been seen as a private matter, but the internet has changed all that. Why have you written this book?
I mean, in part because I couldn't believe no one else had. I mean, you know, it is such a sort of huge seismic shift in the way that we see each other and the way we sort of, well, see ourselves, that it felt really important. And I guess, you know, with Ofcom recently said there were 13 million adults every month tuning into adult sites. So, you know, this is a huge issue. And I think it's changed everything from our laws, from sort of, you know, beauty standards, and indeed, it's even having an impact on, like, the birth rate. I mean, you know, we've seen a sort of plummeting birth rate, and I think that's in part because people aren't relating to one another anymore. They are using pornography.
And I think what some of our older viewers see as adult material is perhaps magazines that used to be around. But the industry doesn't look like that anymore. It's a lot more violent than it used to be.
Yes, it is. So part of the reason for that is that it is addictive. I mean, it fires the same parts of the brain that any other drug does. So it should really be seen in those terms. You know, we're starting to understand that, for example, social media is addictive. So, you know, it gives you a little dopamine rush every time you hit that like or retweet. And it's the same thing, but cemented with an orgasm when it comes to pornography. So it is a very powerful teacher. And that's why men in particular tend to become desensitized to what they see. So they will go to more and more extreme things to get the same sort of hit. And then you see things like, you know, really, really dark genres of pornography becoming very popular. So, you know, we've had a ban recently on choking in pornography, or strangulation, as it's more properly called. And that's something that now nearly 40% of young women have experienced. And, you know, that was almost unheard of just a decade ago. So I think it's really having a clear change, a real impact on how people have sex.
And what's the impact here on young people? You're talking about birth rates. That's an issue that I care deeply about in this country because we need to have more children. What is the direct impact on young people when it comes to pornography?
Well, I think sort of young brains are obviously so plastic, and that's where they learn their sexual scripts from.
Right.
So if you, I mean, we know that now erectile dysfunction used to be a very, very rare problem. It used to affect around about 2 to 3% of men under 30. Now, it's 30%.
Of men under 30?
Yes, of men under 30. I mean, that was unknown just a couple of decades ago. So I think that that really shows what a physical impact pornography is having. And what's particularly, I think, concerning about that is it's not the standard medical condition that you might imagine, because they can just with adult content, not with a flesh and blood human being.
And is that because the content is so racy and different to what real life is that they can't find that arousing, I guess?
Yeah, it's known as a super stimulus. That's something that's sort of, you know, a heightened version of what you get in nature. And it has effectively hacked our brains.
So that's Jo Bartouche. Her book is called Pornocracy. Martin, what about this effect on society? And I suppose this, a lot of this is because of the internet, isn't it?
Well, yes, it's a big change in my lifetime. Because of course it's virtually, it's very difficult to police any of this, even if you want to police it. And so it's obviously having a massive impact on all sorts of human relationships and so on. And we're all, you know, we're moving towards a kind of Brave New World style society, aren't we? Where we're constantly programmed, not just by pornography, but all sorts of other things. And it's, you know, people, you walk down the street and you can see people looking at their phones. And they're banging into things because they're looking at their phones. That didn't used to happen. And, you know, I don't know what the easy solutions are, because I don't think there are any easy solutions.
Okay. Harriet, what about your thoughts on this? I mean, this book is really looking at the changes that the internet and pornography has brought about in society, which is, it's almost a kind of unspoken thing, isn't it?
Yes, well, I found it very interesting. It's not a thing I know much about. I did want to make one point, though, about the birth rate, because, you know, I'm a climate activist with Just Stop Oil, and a lot of the young people in our movement have said they won't have children because of the climate, because they would bring up children to a world that would be basically unbearable to live in. So that is part of the birth rate decline, and also the problems of housing, which we've already mentioned and which we could talk about for ages, because young people simply cannot afford a decent house. Well, and without a decent house, how can you have a child?
Well, this is partly a job of our generation, is to hand on a good world to the next generation.
And we haven't done it.
Well, it's not
that's
up
why
to
so
you
many,
and I.
That's it, why
what I'm
so
saying
many
is it's not
us.
You and I that's not done it. It's just that there is an elite in
yes,
this country
absolutely.
That have betrayed the next
they
generation.
They have, indeed. Absolutely. And that's why so many of us old baby boomers are sitting and protesting, because we do feel, you know, that we've benefited in a way that these poor young people can't. But I'd just like to make one point about the police, which we talked about before, because in these arrests and events, I've been talking to the police. I always talk to police. I was taught to do that by Sue Parfitt, who you've probably come across, the Reverend Sue.
Oh, Martin's mentioned her.
Yes, she's been arrested many, many times, and the police know her and treat her with respect. She's a priest. But anyway, I've talked to these young policemen and said to them, you know, why are you doing this? And they say, well, we can't have a political point of view. We're not allowed to. We can't have political point of view. So I had to say to them, but this isn't really a political issue. It's a moral issue. And they don't have a reply to that. But they also say, we're just doing what we're told. So I say to them, well, that's what the guards in Nazi encampments, concentration camps said when they were doing their horrible things. But I say to them, why don't you complain to your bosses? Because, yes, these young people, these young policemen, you know, they haven't got any power. They are just following what they're told to do, and they have to earn a living. But it's the senior police, like you said, that is worrying, because they should be protesting. They must see that what's happening is wrong. They're arresting a whole lot of old pensioners like me and trying to put them in jail when they're forced to put criminals, real criminals, rapists and violent criminals and drug pushers into the community. Well, I mean, this is just mad.
One thing I've heard from several police over the years is that in order to be promoted to a level of inspector or above, you've got to be a Freemason.
Oh, yes.
So obviously
sense.
All the superintendents yeah. would be Freemasons yeah. and the chief constables or assistant chief constables. So there seems to be a kind of mixture of cowards and control freaks at the police. Yes. So they're either extremely like in controlling, or it's a bit like the press actually, very much similar in the BBC. You know, your senior people are either like swivel-eyed control freaks, or else they just do anything they're told and they believe anything. They've got no mind of their own. But anyway, look, before we finish with you, Harriet, so we've got to have a little, I think, excursion into the Green Party and a look at the Nigel Farage lot because of mass migration. Now, what are your thoughts about this idea of having whatever it is, about 750,000? I think it's a bit less last year, but that sort of rate of migration, net migration into Britain.
Well, obviously it can be seen as a problem. On the other hand, if you think of all the jobs that these migrants do, if they are allowed to stay, we wouldn't really survive without them, because if you go into hospital, as I've done a few times this year, you find that almost everybody that sends you, from the doctors to the porters, is a migrant. And also, similarly, in the hotel industry, when I go to the recycling centre, most of the people there are non-white. Honestly, the British people that are spending their time looking at pornography and gambling are not very keen on doing these kind of low-paid jobs.
Well, I mean, isn't it unskilled low-paid work that doesn't pay anymore? It's very difficult to survive on.
It should pay more. It should pay more. But these poor immigrants, you know, are so desperate that they will take it. And they do a bloody good job, too, in the NHS. Really good. And I think... the other thing you've got to take into account is that more and more parts of the globe, particularly in Africa, are going to become basically uninhabitable, too hot to live in. So more people will be fleeing. And we've got to think about how do we handle this? Mm. You know, is it just going to lead to sort of racist murders? I don't know.
Well, the Greens' attitude is that people should just, as many people as want, should be able to come. So it's not really an issue. At least that's apparently. And it was a good discussion yesterday on BBC Question Time. At least I thought it was, you know, it's useful to have these points made to the new Green leader, Zach Polanski, by Fiona Bruce. One of the rare occasions I've seen her actually make. I always look at these Question Times and think, bring back Dimbleby. Come on.
Oh,
this
yes.
guy really knew his stuff. Fiona Bruce knows her antiques. She doesn't really know her political history or cultural
Indeed.
History. But anyway, so let's have a listen now to a bit of a... This is Zach Polanski, the Green leader, talking about his the Greens' attitude to mass migration. And we'll hear from Nigel Farage finally after this.
The only thing that stops a boat is the weather. Because if it's... whether it is now, they won't come over. And that's the only reason it would stop the boat. So what is about... we're going to stop the boats.
It doesn't work, as far as you're concerned. Jack.
This is exactly right. And it's important to remember we're talking about people. And this is personal to me, and I know it'll be personal to many people watching this programme. My great-grandparents lived in Latvia. They're Jewish, and we fled because of pogroms. We ended up in Ukraine. We fled again. More pogroms. Then in Nazi-occupied Poland. Then fled again. And this is what people have done throughout history. They have fled because they've moved because of war or persecution, or they've moved because of people they love or that they want to travel.
And do you think there should be any limits on those numbers? Judging from your manifesto, you don't.
Well, I think we need to be really clear about the numbers. This year, 800,000 people have arrived in this country. 400,000 of them have come to study. 300,000 of them have come to work and are a net contribution to our tax system.
Yes, but that's answering a different question.
Well,
I'm asking you, Zach, is do you believe, because judging from what the Greens say, though quite often you shy away from it, saying it in public, but what is written down is that you believe in a world without borders, therefore anyone who wants to come should be able to come. Is that correct?
So what's important to know is that when we talk about those numbers, we're talking about a policy for a sustainable society.
You haven't actually answered this.
I'm answering you right now. This is about what it looks like in the future. Yes, in an ideal world, that is the policy I would want. I recognise, though, we are not in an ideal world. We're in a world where the world is in turmoil. We know that we have huge issues in our country. But the issues with the National Health Service, the issues with the lack of council homes, the issues with the society feeling broken, are not the issues of migrants or someone who is clinging to a small boat. They are the issues of 14 years of Conservative austerity, continued by a Labour government who say this is an island of strangers, but actually, you're a government of cowards because you won't tell people the truth about migration. And the truth about migration, it is a positive thing for this country. We need migration. We need fair and managed migration. And that's what will change this conversation.
Woman then.
Okay, so that's Zach Polanski, Green leader, speaking on BBC Question Time Migration Special. Now, one thing I would say watching that, I was from Dover, it was that the audience was surprisingly pro-migrant. Now, I'm not sure if the BBC have stuffed the audience full of pro-migrant people, but it certainly didn't seem to be the sort of conversations that you would normally hear coming out of somewhere like Dover, which is at the front end of this. But anyway, what do you make of this idea that is floated there by Fiona Bruce, Harriet, that this is really just one big world and people should be able to kind of go wherever they feel like?
It's idealistic, but I mean, morally, I'm sympathetic with it. After all, that's what globalisation was all supposed to be about. In fact, it seemed to be more about consolidating the power of the billionaires and millionaires. But in a way, we have to accept that the kind of policies that have happened, the empires of the past, have opened up borders, and we've pushed people all around the world to do work for us. You know, that's what we did. Remember that we also are a mongrel nation. We were invaded by the Romans and then by the Normans, and Danes and Vikings came in there somewhere too. So this sort of idea of national purity, which of course the reform had begun, is just a load of rubbish. You know, we're mixed people, we always have been, and we should be. There may have to be some limits in terms of the provision for people, but this is why we need a wealth tax and stopping giving a lot of money for warfare and buying nuclear jets and all the other things that Keir Starmer, the warmonger, is so keen on.
Martin, what do you think of this whole idea that actually, well, really, borders these days are just not really in fashion?
Well, that's not true, though, is it? I mean, borders are definitely there.
Well, for example, in Hungary, Viktor Orban has made a big deal about this, and they put a big wall up across there. They're having to pay, I think, isn't it, a million euros a day or something, or maybe it's a year. I don't know how much. It's a lot of money they've got to pay to the EU as a fine, because they're not allowing anyone just to come into Hungary at all.
Well, if Hungary wants to leave the EU, and they could do that, they'd get a lot of subsidies from the EU structural funds. So but
some countries have taken a very different approach. What's your approach?
I think you can't get away from the fact that states exist, and states have borders. Borders are always controlled, either successfully or unsuccessfully.
But they're not mostly in Europe, are they? In the EU, they're not.
No, the Schengen area, people, once they're in, can go anywhere apart from us, of course. We can't, yeah, because we're out. So that's one of the reasons why we can't, you know, people who thought they were going to be able to retire to Portugal are not going to be able to do it.
It's a sort of halfway house, isn't it, between a super state and a state, Europe, and lots of states, rather.
Yes, but refugees are not just in Europe. They're all over the world. Yeah. There's a massive war raging in the developing world. We've invaded Afghanistan, we've smashed Iraq, we've smashed Libya, we've put Al-Qaeda in power in Syria.
So how many of these migrants that are coming in to the UK are coming in because of war, and how many because they're trying to make a better life for themselves?
Most of the migrants, as Zach Polanski pointed out, are either coming here to keep our universities going, because that's their bread and butter, or they're coming here to work in the health service. Now, we could, in fact, discourage people from coming to work in the health service, but we've already got massive waiting lists. Yeah. In the social care sector, it's the government that decides the wage rate.
So why are the people coming in on the boats, then? Because they're not doing either of these.
No, the people coming on the boats are trying to claim asylum. Under the existing UN convention, they have to physically be in Britain to claim asylum. And, of course, many of them, are from Afghanistan, the country we've spent 20 years destroying. And, of course, the SAS are currently on trial, or there's an investigation into them shooting toddlers in Afghanistan. And the guy who shot the people up, I sent you the stuff about this, the guy who shot the people up, the two National Guard people who were shot in the US.
Yeah, one is dead, yeah.
One is dead. That guy was a paid assassin for the CIA inside Afghanistan, which is why he had to be brought back to the US, because of the Taliban.
And he's still on the run, I think, isn't he?
Yeah,
so they taught him quite well how to hide.
Well, I don't know, but I think they've caught him, haven't they?
Have they? Or maybe.
Yes,
maybe.
Of course they have, because we know who he is.
Well, the I point think they is, know his name, but I don't think they caught him. Anyway.
No, they have caught him, Tony. All right. The fact is, he was actually a paid killer for the CIA in Afghanistan. That's where he learnt the skills. And we did all of that. The British Army had been defeated three times in Afghanistan now. Three times we've been to Helmand Province, and the local boys have given us a good hiding three times. And it's no use saying, we don't want to come here now. It's ridiculous. Everybody wants to have a war in another country, watch it on the telly and come and have a cup of tea. That's not the real world.
Well, the real world is going to get a lot hotter if and when there's the next general election and reform take power and Nigel Farage becomes Prime Minister, which is certainly the way it's looking. Although, over the last couple of weeks, there's been this campaign to say that he's a racist and that he was anti-Semitic in the 1970s. And I was quite amazed to hear that this is not a news story at all. That it was actually 12 years ago in 2013 that this first got an airing. And here is Michael Crick talking about Farage's alleged racism when he was a school kid back at Dulwich College in South East London, which is just not far from my school, actually. When I was brought up, we all knew about Dulwich College. They were apparently very good at rugby. But here's Farage being interviewed by Michael Crick on Channel 4 News 12 years ago on the same story.
Mr. Farage, would you like to see the letter?
I've seen it before.
Have you?
Well, not for 30 years. Yes, of course, I said some ridiculous things about
racist
them.
Things.
Not necessarily racist things.
Not necessarily racist.
Well, it depends how you define it. You see, I mean, you've got to remember that ever since 1968, up until the last couple of years, we've not been able in this country intelligently to discuss immigration, to discuss integration. It's all been a buried subject, and that's happened through academia, it's happened through politics and the media.
But, I mean, that letter, you know, for instance, it cites an example of you taunting someone in class and having to be excluded.
I was excluded.
By implication on racial grounds.
I was excluded from class dozens of times over the years for all sorts of reasons. No. I don't accept that. You know,
I mean, it's not just that.
I was excluded
fellow
from class.
Pupils remember you making racist comments.
Well, I might have wound some of them up too. But all through.
So you made racist comments to wind people up?
All through the 1970s and 80s, I would counter any received wisdom on any subject quite deliberately. I wasn't alone in doing that. It was a very political school. We had people who were members of very left-wing organisations. We also had boys at school who were members of hard-right organisations.
What about the accusation that you marched through this Sussex village singing Hitler Youth songs?
I don't even know the words. I mean,
maybe you did in those days.
None of this loses anything in the telling, does it? And you know, the truth of it is...
Well, how would a story like that emerge?
There was a small group of people there, in the teaching staff, who wanted to abolish the CCF. They even wanted to abolish wearing poppies and Remembrance Day parade. Can you imagine people being that extreme?
Those left-wing English staff wouldn't have been on the CCF.
Exactly.
So how would they
know
if it wasn't somebody who was there?
Well, as I say, none of this loses anything in the telling. People often believe what they want to believe. That is complete baloney. Was I a difficult, bullshit teenager who pushed the boundaries of debate further than perhaps I ought to have done? Yes. Have I, to some extent, in politics, continued to challenge things that are continued to be unchallengeable? Yes. Have I ever been a member of any extremist organisation, left or right? No.
So this is a resurrected story from 12 years ago. We're not hearing about the hunger strike going on in Pentonville. We are hearing about this. I mean, there's been no actual court case, trial or anything which has proven these allegations. And, you know, if someone has said something, such and such said this at school, that doesn't seem to me to really pass the test to be a proper news story. Although it's going on and on and on. In fact, The Guardian just an hour ago was reporting that a former Dulwich pupil says that Farage told him that's the way back to Africa. Martin?
Well, I think it is a news story, Tony. And it's obviously a news story because people are interested in it. If you want to be the Prime Minister, I'm afraid this is the kind of thing you're going to have to deal with. Farage can say he's not a racist. I've got my opinion. I say he is. He supports Israel. He supports genocide. So does Keir Starmer. He's also a racist because he supports genocide. And if all of this stuff... When this stuff first came out, I thought to myself, how long can I get my head around the idea that Nigel Farage was the Harry Flashman, the school bully of Dulwich College? And suddenly it took me a nanosecond to think, yes, I used to know people like him as well. Yeah. And of course he is like that, and he's still like that, and a lot of people who vote for him are like that, and they are racist. And you can't tell me I can't say that.
No, I'm
that
not.
That is my opinion.
I think it's quite reasonable to suggest that Farage might be a racist, of course.
He certainly is a racist now. I mean, if he was a nasty, difficult bully as a teenager, he's still a nasty, difficult bully as a politician. And the people who support him are equally obnoxious. On
I mean,
the whole.
Isn't there a difference though between trying to stop mass migration and actually being having a go at somebody just because of their race? The idea of mass migration and racism aren't necessarily the same thing, are they?
They're not necessarily the same thing. Of course, people can be worried about migration without being racist, but
especially
not
when
Nigel
just,
Farage,
especially
because he is a racist.
Especially, you can actually be a trade unionist who's worried about undermining pay and conditions and everything.
That's right.
And seeing it all as actually, not Mick Lynch, the guy before him, the big guy from the RMT, used to constantly say this, look, mass migration is undermining the pay and conditions of RMT workers. Bob Crowe, that's the guy. But he wasn't a racist.
No, Bob Crowe wasn't a racist, but Nigel Farage is. Okay, all right. It's quite simple, really.
Let's have a listen to Nigel Farage talking just a couple of days ago.
Must we?
About, yes. Yeah, I mean, because he's got to have... He has his... Of course, Nigel gets his right to reply to the BBC, and here
there's
he was a couple of days ago.
Too much of Nigel on the BBC, let's face
it. Yeah, well, not necessarily.
He's
if he's going to be the next...
far more coverage than Zach Polanski,
yeah,
for example,
because he's likely to be the next Prime Minister, so can we just, I know a lot of people hate Farage, but we need to hear from him if he's going to be the next Prime Minister, don't we?
I thought this morning's performance by one of your lower grade presenters on the Today programme was utterly disgraceful. I think to frame a question around the leader of Reform's relationship with Hitler, which is how she framed it, was despicable, disgusting, beyond belief. Are you surprised that 500,000 people every year refuse to pay the licence fee? But let me say this to you. The double standards and hypocrisy of the BBC are absolutely astonishing. At the time I was alleged to have made these remarks, one of your most popular weekly shows was the Black and White Minstrels. Right? The BBC were very happy to use blackface. Oh, and not just in the Black and White Minstrels, you did it in It Ain't Half Hot Mum as well. And what about Alf Garnett? Do you remember what he called Marigold? Do you remember the word he used to describe Marigold on live, not live, but on primetime national TV? I better not repeat the word, otherwise you'll all use it and say that I used it. Homophobia? It Ain't Half Hot Mum? Are you being served? Oh, and what about Bernard Manning? Perfectly happy at exactly the same time for Bernard Manning to appear on primetime national BBC comedy, telling jokes for which these days you'd probably get a knock at the door from our thought police and perhaps get a 31-month prison sentence. I cannot put up with the double standards of the BBC about what I'm alleged to have said 49 years ago and what you were putting out on mainstream content. So I want an apology from the BBC for virtually everything you did throughout the 1970s and 80s. And I will respond to your direct question. I've received many letters over the course of the last few days from people that I was at school with. This one I think is particularly relevant. I was a Jewish pupil at Dulwich College at the same time, and I remember him very well. While there was plenty of macho, tongue-in-cheek schoolboy banter, it was humour. And yes, sometimes it was offensive, rather like most of the BBC's output. But never with malice. I never heard him racially abuse anyone. If he had, he would have been reported and punished. He wasn't. The news stories are without evidence, except for belatedly politically dubious recollections from nearly half a century ago. Back in the 1970s, the culture was very different. Perhaps, Damon, you should reflect on that. Especially at Dulwich, lots of boys said things they'd regret today, or just laugh at. Whilst Nigel stood out, he was neither aggressive nor a racist. If I can help in any way, let me know. And I've had plenty of those messages over the course of the last few days, and I'm sick to death of the double standards and hypocrisy, above all, of your organisation. And what happened on the Today programme this morning was a complete disgrace.
Well, I'm not sure exactly what it was on the Today programme, but, I mean, he's making a pretty good point there, Harriet. He's saying, actually, back in the mid-1970s, standards were very different, and the BBC shows he quotes prove that.
Well, Ralph Garnett was satirical, basically, for a start. I mean, yeah, OK, so things were different in the 70s. I mean, he's a clever person, Farage. That's where he's got where he is, but he's deeply dangerous. And after all, we know that Trump has also accused the BBC of being a sort of lefty hub, which is absolutely ridiculous since it's completely
right. Well, I mean,
it's look,
I mean, Trump is absolutely right to criticise the BBC. In fact, he's suing them now.
I think he's wrong.
No, he's right, for because the BBC did distort what he said at that rally. They completely edited out. They took two completely separate sections of they were trying to make out that he was trying to send all of his supporters down to Congress or wherever it was, House of Representatives or something, in Washington, in order to fight them. And he wasn't saying that at all, but the BBC edited it to make it sound like he was, deliberately.
Well, I think they have actually sort of apologised for that. I don't know, I haven't seen this programme.
This is where the media is very dangerous. If they're starting to, to try to basically play judge and jury in our politics, which, I mean, I suppose increasingly over the last 20, 30 years they've been doing this.
But Tony, you said you've trained as a journalist. All journalists cut and stitch together. I've been interviewed quite a lot by journalists, and what comes out...
We don't distort. The idea is if I waffle, right, let's cut it out. If I say the wrong... If I play a wrong clip, if I play, for example, an advert in the middle of a Tucker Carlson interview, we can edit it out, but I'm never going to distort what's being said. And that's what the BBC did with that particular interview.
Well, I can't comment on that because I haven't seen the interview.
Well,
so,
they did. You know, all I'm saying is that most media has an agenda of some sort, whether it's a left-wing agenda or a right-wing. I mean, look at Rupert Murdoch, for example. He's megally pro-Israeli. Everything that he does is... anti-Palestinian. He's a faction of his own. He's probably almost certainly directly connected to the Israeli intelligence services. GB News is as well, maybe not quite so bad. All of the only supposed fair arbiter is the BBC. LBC, by the way, is quite left-wing. You know, so you've got various, and you've got this absurd situation now in ownership in British press where you've got the Daily Mirror, which is left-wing, and the Daily Express, which is right-wing, both owned by the same newspaper company.
It's
obvious they've got their left-wing arm and they've got their right-wing arm, and they're trying to distort everything we see and polarise, I suppose, thinking and control.
Well, that's why I don't watch BBC News, frankly. I get my news from comrades on Twitter and
social media. But you see, that can be manipulated. You've got Elon Musk. Elon Musk is in charge of the social media. Oh my God,
it is terrifying.
Yeah, well, this is why we try and do something about that here. We, you know, the idea is let's judge each story on its merits and not distort. And if I'm editing, I can assure you, I'm not editing out something to distort the view.
Good,
because that's what I do, and I like to hear the best from both sides, even if they're both wrong. Anyway, Martin, what do you make of Farage? Is he going to be a really horrific racist prime minister when he takes over?
He's not going to be prime minister, Tony.
We hope so.
Well, I think, look, the opinion polls got them about 30% in a proportional system. It's interesting because he used to be in favour of proportional representation.
Can you just answer the question? If he does...
If he does, I'm not going to accept it unless he's got 50% of the vote. We're going to have revolution.
You're going to start a revolution, are you?
Yes, and of course what may happen, Plaid Cymru will win in Wales and SNP will win in Scotland, and the breakup of the former UK will continue, just like in Yugoslavia, where I was an aid worker, if you remember, in the 1990s. Lots of people ran away when people came to kill them in the Krajina. They were all Serbs. The Croatians, with the full backing of NATO, drove them all out, killed hundreds of them. And of course, we were behind all of that.
Yeah.
And it's not very far away. It's a lot closer than the United States Israel.
I wonder if a lot of this stuff happens in... I mean, this is an... I think it's just only about a minute clip we're about to hear, but we've had the German Chancellor in UK this week.
Oh,
and I'm not
God,
saying he's a Nazi. I'm not saying that. I'm really not saying
his
that.
His grandfather was.
But his grandfather was a Nazi, and... I'm sure he's not at all. He's a very nice man. But the interesting thing is where he comes when he comes to Britain. Now, this is completely different from our previous monarch, Queen Elizabeth.
Inside the castle is luncheon, and the king will lead Mr. Frank Steinmeier, who is the federal president of the Federal Republic of Germany, in through the sovereign's entrance and up the stairs for that lunch. Following on behind, the queen with Elke Budenbender, who is a recently retired judge in Berlin, the wife of the president, and the Prince and Princess of Wales. And during lunch, there will be other members of the suite, members of the royal household, as they prepare for an extremely busy few days on this, the first state visit by the head of state of Germany to the United Kingdom for 27 years. The Honourable Corps of Gentlemen at Arms are in position as the royal standard flies.
So that's the German president, sorry, not the Chancellor, visiting. Thanks, Marty, for pointing that and shouting at me during the clip there. But anyway, the point is, and of course he's definitely not a Nazi, but the point is he's coming to Windsor. The king seems to be taking a much more upfront role in the national politics and international politics than the Queen did, Harriet,
yeah,
doesn't she?
I agree. I mean, but... I feel conflicted about Charles because, you know, he used to be a tree hugger and I thought he was quite a good guy, but he, you know, he seems to be hand in glove with Starmer, so I'm a bit sceptical. And I do think that the money that's spent on all this parading at this time when people are suffering, when, I don't know, I can't remember the percentage, but it's very high of children in Britain. It's about, Martin, can you remember, 25% or something?
In poverty.
Yeah, it's really horrible. So I just think this isn't the best way for us to be cementing relations with people. And King Charles is always flying about in a private helicopter as well. So I'm conflicted.
Usually with his Bentley tied on the back of the helicopter. But anyway, so this is a problem, isn't it? The if the head of state is trying to sort of take control and they're a monarch and they're not elected in any way, when you've got a weak government, a weak prime minister, this starts to become a problem, doesn't it?
Yes, I think you're right. I'm going to have to go now, Martin, if that's okay.
Yep, that's fine.
Enjoyed this session very much. Thanks for listening to me and interrupting me quite a lot.
Anyway, Harriet, how do people find and follow you, Harriet, if they're interested in keeping up with what you're up to?
They would.
And following your case, of course.
I'm on Twitter.
You're on Elon Musk.
I am. Well, I'm part of something called Intelligent Lefties, there are some good people on there.
Good.
Of course, we all deplore Elon Musk, and sometimes people get banned, but I've never been banned, so I just try to.
You've been shadow banned. That's what you said. He shadow bans people like you.
Yeah. No, he hasn't. He's never done it.
Well, yeah, but you don't know because you just don't appear on other people's feeds and you don't know.
I do.
Oh, you do? Okay,
I can
good.
Tell you that
I'm
followed by Zach Polanski and Greta Thunberg, which I feel quite proud about. They're always liking my posts.
Maybe it's Elon's AI that likes you. Anyway, we'll be back after the break.
Okay.
After the break.
Right.
Christ in our I seen him on the box once with his black shirt on. And though I cannot claim to be any great authority, as far as I'm concerned, the sun shone out of his oratory. Rather than a great dictator, given half a chance, but I treated him like a traitor, so he went to live in France. Century, brilliant debater, gifted, lucid and compassionate. He was the only man to give up on
I am Mark.
Oh, hello, Mark. Please come in. You'll meet the others who live here.
Sorry, but... work.
watched her husband. She knew exactly what to do. A pseudonym to fool him. She couldn't have made a worse move. She sent him 70 letters, and he received them with a strange delight. Just like his wife, then how she was before the tears. And how she was before the years flew by. And how she was when she was beautiful. She sang the letter on. Babushka, 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 ya, ya.
Kate Bush and Babushka. Do you know why I played that? Well, if you're a fan of Not the 9 o'clock News, it's really their version of the Kate Bush song, which has got to be seen maybe next week, eh? Seen and Heard to Be Believed, which was a great Pamela Anderson dressed up as Kate Bush with the massive, massive loads and loads of hair, being extremely sexually provocative on stage and making out that, well, anyway, I'll leave it for your imagination, that one, but that's why I played that. And that was 1986, Babushka from Kate Bush. Before that, we had the Railway Jam from St. Etienne, 1993, I think. And then the Oswald Mosley song before that. Now, that's a bit of a, you know, obviously with the Farage stuff going on. This is what Not the 9 o'clock News were doing, a satire against Oswald Mosley and the fascists back in, I think that was again, mid-1980s. And that's on their, oh gosh, is it called Hedgehog Sandwich, Martin? Do you remember that? An LP that the Not the 9 o'clock News people put out, which is an absolutely brilliant little, one of those marvellous little items of comedy from the days when British television had comedy on it, which it doesn't anymore. And right at the very start, we had Christ Be Our Light. So, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show, the Bristol Politics Show, with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Martin, I want an explanation from you now as to what's going on with this Ukraine peace deal. I think maybe we'll hear in a minute, but maybe not first, but in a minute from Putin himself, who's over in India at the moment. But the point here is that we had Victoria Nuland and the rest of them kicking off a coup in Ukraine in 2014, and the rest sort of falling to an attempt by NATO and the European Union based in Brussels, both of them, to take over the country, and then this proxy war, which they which they've provoked, which Farage was right in saying they provoked last year, into 2022, where they were about to attack the Donbass with the Ukraine army, and so the Russians came in to defend the Donbass, and now the Russians are saying they want the whole Donbass. So why is it that the Americans started this war, but the Europeans seem determined to finish it?
Well, the linkages between the deep state in the US and the European Union and the UK is pretty strong, and the Trump faction in the US wants to get out of the war in Ukraine because they want to go to war with Venezuela, they want to go to war with Iran, they want to go to war with China, and the Ukraine has become a bit of a diversion.
So it's nothing to do with the fact that that Putin has got some amazing nuclear weapons with which he could devastate continental United States at any time they want.
Well, that's always been the case. So that's nothing. There's no change there. I think the fact is that the Russian army have basically won the war, and there's nothing really to discuss. Both the Europeans and the Americans seem to be under the illusion that they can dictate to the Russians what they can and can't do. But it's not, in fact, if you look at your history books, you will find that people who lose wars are not in a position to dictate the outcome. And they're not going to win. They were never going to win. They've caused an awful lot of destruction and misery by provoking the war in the first place. And don't forget, there were three solid deals which could have prevented the war, all of them sabotaged by the West.
Yeah, well, so why is it seems amazing to me. We've had this week an unbelievable statement from this complete moron. He's called Admiral Giuseppe Cavo Dragone, with a great Dragone, Italian, who is the chief of staff of NATO of some sort, chair of the NATO Military Committee. This week he's saying that we must have preemptive strikes against Russia because of hybrid warfare. So a cyber attack, which may or may not be Russia, happens. Maybe it's Marks and Spencer's has been cyber attacked, maybe the Ministry of Defence. And as a result, we should then preemptively strike Russia.
Well, he said preemptively, there doesn't have to be a Russian strike. That's a whole pingback preemption.
Well, there's no military strike by Russia, but we will strike them first.
Yes,
because they have done something to our cyber security.
Well, I mean, they're talking all
but
this...
We don't know. When a cyber attack happens, we don't know who's done it.
No, we don't. We don't know who's been flying all these drones around suddenly while we're trying to whip up the population into spending more money on going to war with Russia. What Putin has said this week is we've got no intention whatsoever of attacking any other European country, and we'll even
apart from Britain.
Well, no,
he
didn't say that.
It's of course, sort of thing he might
but he said if you want a war with us, you will get one. And of course, they won't actually drive their tanks to the channel.
They said they're ready
at Portsmouth.
What he said is they're absolutely ready for war with Europe if they want to have a war.
That's
they are ready for it, and he believes they'll win.
Well, they will win. Of course they will. They've got the best army in the world now that's been fighting solidly for 3 years. It's the best training you could possibly have. If the British army turned up mob-handed, all of them, 70,000 soldiers.
Haven't they been training in Ukraine too, though?
No, they haven't.
Haven't there been British...
They have been training the Ukrainians, and they've also been fighting in the Ukraine, and many of them are dead. That's no doubt about it. The British have been particularly... busy in involvement in what's gone on in the Ukraine. So the assassination of Zakhachenko in 2017, who was the elected prime minister of the Donbass Republic, his head was blown off by a bomb in a restaurant. That's got British MI6 fingerprints all over it, and the Russians are very well aware of that. And the assassination of Kirillov, who was the one who's exposing the COVID experiments in the biolabs in the Ukraine. Now, the Russians are absolutely prepared for a major war with the West. They don't want a major war with the West. They never have. But they know they've got to prepare for it, and it would be remiss of them if they didn't prepare for it. The people on our side are delusionary. There is absolutely no way they can put together a force which can take on the Russians. They simply can't do it. It's not even worth trying. It's a waste of time.
Diplomatic political advisor and academic was a chap called Sir Crispin Tickell. He was played a key role in forming British government policy on environment. His son is Oliver Tickell, who was the editor up until a few years ago of a magazine called The Ecologist. He's taking a great interest these days in geopolitics, particularly between Russia and the EU.
From my perspective, this has always been an American operation in which the Europeans were the victims. There are actually three victims in all of this. One of them is Russia. One of them is Ukraine. They're the biggest victim of all. And the other one is Europe. This operation was never in European interest, because actually the Europeans were doing really well, having at least fairly good relations with Russia and a good, reliable commercial partnership, basically with Europe buying European gas and oil and minerals at low prices, keeping the European economy competitive. The American interest was in part to weaken Russia, because their policy, long-term policy, is to have full-spectrum global dominance over any other power, and they realized that Russia was beginning to challenge that power, and that it was no longer kowtowing to the American and NATO interest. But I think a major purpose of it at that time was to wrench Europe away from Russia, to disrupt that productive relationship between Europe and Russia, and force Europe onto what they call the American energy platform, which basically means instead of buying cheap Russian gas, that Europe would have to buy expensive American gas. And that is exactly what is now happening with Europe buying imported American liquefied natural gas at something like four times the price that they were paying Russia to have it piped in. The outcome is that the European economy is at a macro level uncompetitive, and all of us are feeling that, with stagnant growth, high inflation, and a general sense of economic stagnation. So to carry on to what has changed, I think that that one big thing that has changed is that Trump actually sees commercial opportunities with Russia, and you could say that this is a sort of a part two. It's a rather clever kind of switcheroo, because Trump thinks, hey, you know, Russia's got all these resources and we've got companies that can go in and exploit them. So he would actually at this point now like to have American companies getting into Russia and exploiting those opportunities, and all the more so now that Europe very foolishly has allowed that relationship to be disrupted. And Europe's collective interest, in my opinion, is actually that they should be the ones resuming that productive commercial relationship. And the mystery is, why aren't they doing that? Why are they going along with this war, which was never, in my opinion, a war in Europe's interests? Why are they doubling down on that? Now, as regards how willingly Europe went into it, certainly when Russia actually went into Ukraine, we instantly doubled down on the sanctions and everything. But going back to 2014, I think there was a different view. Clearly, the EU was trying to attract Ukraine into a partnership, but they really couldn't offer enough money. The deal that they were offering was a poor one. But they were reluctant to back that coup. And one example of that is the famous Victoria Nuland quote on that recorded phone call, the EU. Because Europe was still trying to smooth over the cracks, and Victoria Nuland didn't want those cracks smoothed over. She wanted to blow the whole thing wide open, hence the EU. And the EU did indeed get well and truly. But But now the question is, you know, why is Europe so damn keen on keeping it going when America is basically trying to pull back?
Well, it's a good question. Surely, you know, one organisation very, very important that you haven't mentioned is NATO, based in Brussels. NATO is increasingly extending its reach to Asia-Pacific region, etc. I mean, surely they've played quite an important role in this. They're the sort of higher power amongst the intelligence agencies of Western Europe and the US.
Well, yes, but... NATO clearly is itching for this war, but why is the EU going along with it? You could say that there's that NATO is largely composed now of European Union members. So the question is, why do these European leaders see it as being in Europe's interests to pursue and commit so heavily to this war with Russia? You know, of course, they talk about matters of high principle and so on, and how this was an unprovoked attack by a dictator against a free and sovereign nation. Of course, we know that that is a very incomplete version of the story.
Oliver. NATO this week has announced that it's considering preemptive action against Russia's hybrid warfare attacks. The chair of the NATO military committee says a more aggressive approach is needed to deter Putin. So this is clearly coming from Brussels. This is clearly coming from NATO. They're actually talking about NATO attacking Russia. They're saying that Russia is doing things like killing people in Salisbury. It's doing cyber attacks. And so quite clearly there is a push from NATO to actually start attacking Russia.
There is. There is a big push from NATO to militarize and potentially attack Russia. When I say potentially, of course, NATO troops are in Russia already. Britain is very active in this. We are directing drones at targets across the Black Sea. Recently, Russian oil tankers have been hit. Drone strikes have taken place in Sevastopol. These are NATO actions, and NATO is increasingly close to being an unquestionably active participant in this. But underlying this is, why does Europe and NATO, and NATO and Europe can't really be separated, because it comes down to the same national leaders who are making these decisions. So why does NATO and Europe, you know, but specifically European leaders, why do these European leaders, from Keir Starmer to Macron and the rest of them, see this as being in their interest?
Okay, so let me float something as a possibility here, Oliver, and that is that we've got really an elite running things. There's very little feedback, if any at all, from the public through the voting system anymore around Europe. Maybe a bit in the States, but not a lot. You know, there's really only elite representatives of various sorts seem to be getting into the position where anyone can vote for them. And surely, you know, they're realizing exactly what you said at the start, that Europe is finished economically, and they've sort of painted themselves into a corner. So they're looking for someone to blame. Russia is right on the doorstep. And in a way, this is almost like a fevered attempt to constantly point the finger to divert attention of their public away from their total failures.
Well, that could be part of it. Another thing is that maybe Europe really does think that it can break Russia. If so, I think they're wrong. I think no way is Europe going to break Russia. I think Europe is much more vulnerable than Russia is, and they will be the losers. But I think that Europe maybe does have this illusion that it can break Russia. And that having broken Russia, that they can carry out the what was originally an American plan to balkanize Russia and to open it up to exploitation over its natural resources, which are huge.
Well, those natural resources, that's Oliver Tickell, by the way. Put the full version up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. The natural resources, the Europeans, the Swiss, the Brits, all thought that they had those natural resources back in the 1990s. Putin turned the tables on them, didn't he, when he took over in 2000?
He did. And, of course, people in the West failed to recognise that what happened in Russia in the 1990s, and I was peripherally involved in it, was absolutely horrendous. When I first went to Leningrad, as it then was, they changed it to St. Petersburg the weekend I was there. I was talking to, you know, young Russians, and they were very, very pro-Western. They were saying to me, well, we just want to be like you.
Well, they'd be listening to Western music, watching films, saying, this whole Soviet thing is rather dry.
Yes.
We've had a terrible time with the economy. Let's just join the West.
That's right. So that was the attitude. And then, of course, I was, you know, somewhat sceptical, having lived in Thatcherite Britain.
Yeah.
And I was very much sort of, you know, it wasn't me to tell them what to think, but I was just kind of putting a few questions in their mind. Are you sure this is going to work? And, of course, they were really deluded at that stage. Yeah. They thought it was, all we've got to do is just copy Thatcher and everybody's going to be rich.
There's been a lot of delusion, hasn't there, over this?
Not worked out
like that. Phil B, McLean, all these people were spying for the Soviet Union. Then some of them that went over there realised, well, actually, this is what it's really like. Yes, we want to overthrow the class system, the sort of feudal class system, the capitalist system. And then they go to Russia and they realise, oh, it's not actually quite as good as we thought it was going to be. So there's been bamboozling on both sides over the decades. But anyway, back to this question on Ukraine. Why is it that the Europeans are insistent on keeping this going? The Americans are now clearly trying to stop it. They've decided, look, let's just cash it in. Is it just simply because the arms companies are more powerful in Europe, or are there other motives that are keeping these European leaders trying to keep this this war on the go?
Well, you'll be familiar with the term path dependency, Tony, which is that when you've taken certain decisions, you end up with you get the sort of sunk cost fallacy. We've spent so much money on this, and we've tried to do it so, you know, that we can't turn back, even though it's obvious that we can't win.
Isn't it like the emperor's new clothes? Actually, yep. No one dares say Ukraine is lost and there's nothing we can do.
That's right. Well, I mean, you've still got, I mean, I follow all this quite closely. You've still got mainstream media like the Telegraph and all these other, you know, rags going on about how Ukraine's path to victory. It's just absurd. Ukraine is going to be thoroughly, completely defeated, and the Russians don't want to take over the Ukrainian speaking of
this is
Ukraine.
One of the things that annoys me more than almost anything is hearing all of the mass media talking about the full-scale invasion day after day, week after week. If this was a full
unprovoked
scale, oh, yes, that's right, of course. Well, it was provoked, and it's not a full-scale invasion, so they're getting very fevered. And in a way, the only thing they can do, because everything has collapsed with Ukraine on the ground pretty much now, in terms of the ability to actually fight the Russians. The Russians are now pushing, gently pushing forward, and they're running out of Ukrainians, as Oliver says in the longer interview, running out of people. They just can't keep fighting anymore. But what they can do is they can still have the Skripal case, those frightening Russians in Salisbury.
Yes, there was an inquiry this week, wasn't there?
Anyway, Craig Murray talks about the Skripals. So the actual news story this week is that Putin was morally responsible, some judges decided.
Well, yes, because of this was Dawn Sturgis, who died from the so-called perfume bottle. My suspicion is that she was deliberately murdered by MI6, because it's MI6 behind the whole operation, and they needed a dead body, and she was it, a rubbish person to be got rid of.
Well,
NATO have been doing things like that for years.
Let's drill into it, because, I mean, I do, it's like a little bit like the 7/7 London bombings. I was a reporter in London, and actually, no, as a researcher in London, this to be absolutely straight, this is to get people onto the radio to talk live across London for the BBC back in 1989, 1990, 1991, that sort of period. And that 7/7 London bombings really annoyed me, because I'm thinking, look, if we were reporting on this, we'd say this. And of course, I've done quite a lot of work on 7/7. I feel the same exact thing with Skripal and Salisbury, in that the lies that have been told are personal to me. And for example, what you're talking about, Dawn Sturgis and Charlie Rowley, someone was commenting on my Facebook earlier. Said, well, apparently other people had died who had been friends of Charlie Rowley, who were addicts. And that Dawn Sturgis almost certainly was. I can't say she was, but it certainly looks likely that she was an addict, and that she died of fentanyl poisoning. In fact, the month before the Skripal attack, Wiltshire police had been putting out warnings of very dangerous contaminated fentanyl that was killing people, killing addicts in that area. So that is almost certainly how Dawn Sturgis really died, Martin.
Well, yes, and Novichok is designed to kill whole populations of massive conurbations. It's not used for individual murders of any kind. The whole story, I mean, Diliana Gatasheva, who's a Bulgarian journalist who's sadly withdrawn from journalistic work, but she showed that there was no chain of custody from the site where the Skripals were supposedly poisoned to pick up the stuff that should have been taken to be tested. Now, if there's no chain of custody, it's quite easy for the state to just make stuff up. And this is very, very strange timing. The World Cup was just about to kick off in Russia. The whole world was going to Russia for a great big holiday. And, of course, the British and the Americans were determined to start a war with Russia, and that's what the Skripal affair is all about. It's actually our intelligence services who murdered Dawn
Sturgis. I think it was actually Amesbury, not Salisbury, that this happened. But a police officer who wrongly described, big inverted commas, Novichok victim Dawn Sturgis as a well-known drug addict has apologised. Wiltshire Police's Superintendent Kerry Laws, L-A-W, ES told an inquiry into Ms. Sturgis's death that there was no intelligence to support her comment. So where had she come up with that from? No idea. But also that Wiltshire Police were putting out all over the internet and in the local newspapers, watch out for this bad batch of fentanyl. They were saying that too. So that's just one aspect to all of this. But another is this whole idea of the Novichok. Now, the Novichok was on a door handle. The two Skripals, they got ill actually in central Salisbury, nowhere near this door handle, but the one person that they were having a meal with was this guy Pablo Miller from MI6, and it was literally just after they'd been meeting with him that they got ill.
Well, that's right, and there's other basic things.
It's Zizi's restaurant.
Yes, there's other basic things that people need to get about this. Novichok is not the kind of poison you would use to kill an individual person. It's a military-grade poison for killing huge numbers of people. Even tiny bits of Novichok are absolutely deadly, and you saw at one stage you've got people wandering around with hazmat suits on, meanwhile police officers with no hazmat suits on casually standing around in the same space as the people with the hazmat suits on. It's all theatre. Mm. And of course, what the Russians suspect is that Skripal and Yulia, his daughter, have been murdered. That's what they suspect.
A couple of miles north
by the British.
A couple of miles north of Salisbury is
Stonehenge.
Porton Down. Please, come on. Porton Down, Martin, which is the headquarters of the Britain's Chemical and Biological Weapons Research Establishment and Storage Establishment. So it wasn't very far for any kind of weird, nasty. And also, of course, Salisbury's a very military town. So there's loads of stuff that doesn't add up. And what I will do is I'll recirculate this amazing little document that came out, I think it was in 2018, called The Alternative Skripal Narrative, which puts together a much more plausible case as to what really happened. And what I find so disgusting is the way that the judiciary is just marshalling in a whole bunch of lying individuals to set up some sort of ridiculous, silly story just to prop up British foreign policy and basically to keep their jobs. So they've got no integrity whatsoever, these people. So anyway, let's have a listen now to someone that really does know about this. That is Craig Murray. He was speaking at the Beautiful Days Festival earlier this year, all on this very specific topic. And Craig is one of the people who's pointed out many of the anomalies in the Skripal story.
Now, you are spraying a supposedly instantaneously acting, although it didn't, poison on the door handle in order to kill somebody. And you're in Salisbury. And you haven't been in disguise. You haven't been hiding yourself. You've been wandering around the streets. And you've done this in broad daylight on a residential estate where anyone could have seen you. So what is your getaway plan? You go into town, you do some window shopping, and then you get on a train on a Sunday. We all know what the Sunday train service is like. Surely, if the Russians had actually done this, they would have had an immediate, fast getaway out of Salisbury lined out. The notion that they did this, then wandered around looking in shops, and then got on a Sunday railway train in order to make their escape, it's just not tradecraft. It's just not. I can tell you, somebody who has a certain amount of tradecraft, it's not. They would not have done that any more than they would have got completely f***ed on vodka hours before making a dangerous assassination attempt. And this idea that they then desealed the perfume bottle in order to put it in the bin, why? Why would you reseal it? What would be the point? Well, think of it. Think of a good reason to actually carry a portable heat sealer and which there's no evidence they were carrying, and then seal up neatly the perfume bottle and leave it somewhere. They weren't intending, they were apparently supposed to be killing Sergei Skripal. They weren't intending to randomly kill people on the streets of Salisbury. Well, why would you do that? It's obvious nonsense. It's just nonsense. Let me give you another thing, which is nonsense. The police searched what it was actually in one of the slides we saw. It was actually in one of the newspaper slides we saw there. After the death of Dawn Sturgis, the police searched Charlie Rowley's flat. A huge team of police searched Charlie Rowley's flat. They were looking for a file containing Novichok. They searched for 5 days and found nothing. And on the fifth day, they found a perfume bottle sitting on the kitchen counter. You're a team of policemen. You're in this house. You are looking for a file of liquid. And there's a perfume bottle sitting on the kitchen counter, and it takes you 5 days to find it. Now, because the inquiry, frankly, was a farce, there was no real representation of people to question the official narrative, very much wasn't actually raised. But this point was raised. This point was actually made at the public inquiry. The police were asked why it took them 5 days to find this bottle of Novichok on the Christmas on the counter. And I swear to you, this is true. The reply at the public inquiry was, it took us 5 days to find it because it was behind the washing up. I've actually got a load of Palestine Action stuff in my house. I'm going to go home and stick it behind the washing up because the police will never, ever, never find it there. It's bollocks. It's absolute. You are being sold a lie, and you are being sold a lie to prepare you for massive injections of your money into the weapons industry to demonize Russia. It's worse than the time of the Cold War. The Americans have sent 3 lots of new nuclear weapons into Lakenheath in the last month, and nobody has even bothered to comment on it. We are being put on a militaristic footing. Keir Starmer's talking of economic growth coming from increasing the funding of the military industry. And it's all based on stories which are simply untrue. and the nonsense behind so much of the story. The idea that these top assassins couldn't kill these people, the idea that they both simultaneously got ill 7 hours after touching the Novichok, the idea that the chief nurse of the British Army found them, the idea it took the police 5 days to find the perfume bottle on the kitchen counter. These are only some of them. As Tim so kindly said, there's an article I've written called Pure, 10 Points I Don't Believe. Millions and millions of people have read it. It's very easy to Google and find. In which I list 10 of these points are things which are simply and utterly unbelievable. I'll give you another one. The policeman, Nick Bailey, his name was, who unfortunately got ill, allegedly through Novichok. He supposedly got nerve agent on the light switches and the door handles internally all over his home. All over his home. And when this was announced, it was asked why his family, who had continued to live in the home for 2 days, hadn't got any on their hands when they touched light switches or door handles. And the Home Office spokesman replied, and this is the official line, it was a miracle. You have to believe in miracles to believe the official story. We are subject to brainwashing. This is actually probably the worst, most laughable brainwashing attempt I've ever seen, and it only succeeds because of the unanimous control of our state and billionaire-owned media who pump out this nonsense to you. I hope that's given you food for thought. I'd be very happy to take questions and to have further discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris.
So that's Craig Murray speaking earlier this year at the Beautiful Days Festival. I'll put a complete version of that whole discussion, that talk, which has got several other contributors, I think, including Patrick Henningsen, up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. If you're still in any doubt about the extent of the lies by the judiciary now, as well as the mass media, as well as Parliament, as well as the Ministry of Defence, as well as the Army, as well as Porton Down, I think Porton Down actually were questioning this whole business at one point, weren't they, quite early on in all this, saying, well, actually, no, it wasn't necessarily from Russia, this Novichok.
Well, also, of course, there's the doctor who was in charge of the hospital where they were treated, who wrote a letter to the Times saying nobody has been treated for poisoning of any nerve agent whatsoever. In other words, the people in the hospital said it wasn't Novichok, it was something else, possibly fentanyl, as you suggested, in the case of Skripal and Yulia. And, of course, Novichok, if you touch it, you immediately die.
The fentanyl is probably to do with the Dawn Sturgis.
Well, no, but I mean, the point is that something happened to Skripal and his daughter in the restaurant, and when they left the restaurant, that's when they collapsed. So that there's no way that Novichok on a door 7 hours earlier is going to kill you 7 hours later. It kills you straight away, or it doesn't kill you at all. The whole story is a fabrication by MI6 working to try and provoke a war with Russia to steal the resources of Russia.
So whereabouts are the Skripals?
The Russians suspect they are dead. They've been saying, we want access to our nationals, please. Don't forget, Yulia was about to go home back to Russia to get married.
He was. He wanted to go back. In fact, there was letter. Yes. A letter was intercepted from Sergei Skripal to the Russian government saying if they could pardon him, he would rather like to come back home. Is that possible? Could they do a deal?
Yes.
In other words, MI6 don't want that.
No, they don't. And, of course, he knows too much.
What about this guy Pablo Miller, who was having a little meal with them just before they got ill?
Well, I would say he's a prime suspect for the person who put whatever did to whatever. And of course, the head of the British Army's medical unit, a colonel, turns up right on just as they collapsed. This whole thing is a murder plot by our secret services. And MI6 do murder plots. They murdered Zakhachenko. I mentioned him earlier, the Prime Minister of the Donbass Republic. Blew his head off. They murdered Kirillov in Moscow. Yeah, the Russians are very well aware of what MI6 is and does. But of course, most people in Britain, apart from in places like West Belfast, don't know. They just presume that they're there to protect us, but they're not. They never have been.
Anyway, who is this Pablo Miller guy? Well, apparently he was born in 1960, former intelligence officer with SIS, MI6. An officer in the Royal Tank Regiment, together with Mark Urban, who suddenly went on to the television. I think he's popped up on Murdoch's channel or something now. He was an ex-BBC guy. So Russian intelligence has claimed that Pablo Miller was a senior officer in MI6 while working undercover as the first secretary of the British Embassy in Tallinn, Estonia. The MI6 officer under diplomatic cover in Moscow at this time is Christopher Steele. So they're quite friendly, these two.
Yes, and of course the Steele dossier was cooked up to discredit Trump. And of course also he claimed that Paul Manafort went to see Julian Assange in the embassy, but he didn't. I mean,
Miller worked for former MI6 Christopher Steele's London-based private intelligence firm, Orbis Business Intelligence, which produced the Steele dossier, which later imploded as a so-called Russiagate inquiry.
That's right. Now, what you've got to recognise, listeners, is that intelligence agencies lie. It is their raison d'être. They are there to lie and disinform. They're not there to tell you what's really going on. They're there to mould your mind so that you will follow in the direction that the deep state wants you to go, which means going to war with Russia, not really going to war with Russia. They may just get, it's like dogs who chase buses. They may actually catch the bus. But in actual fact, what they really want to do is just spend loads of money on weaponry for the companies which they sit on the board.
Well, one of the clues when there's a cover-up is that the British government issues things called D-notices. Would you like to tell us what a D-notice is? I mean, I can, but why don't you?
Well, I mean, D-notices have become somewhat... You know, because they used to basically, it's a military committee
that decides that we are going to advise the London press not to publish something.
That's right, but of course, that's not really the way the world works.
Sitting
now,
on
is
a
it?
Story. But it is. No, it is the way the world works. Because I think much of what happens with the London press, particularly, is completely steered by the people like the press office at the Ministry of Defence, etc. So in 2018, the British government issued 2D notices after the poisoning of Sergei and Yulia Skripal in March 2018 with a Novichok nerve agent, allegedly, in Salisbury. These D notices instructed the British media not to report that Pablo Miller, was then a retired MI6 agent, had recruited Sergei Skripal to MI6, as MI6 agent Miller was also known as Antonio Alvarez de Hidalgo. According to the FSB, Miller was also in contact with Alexander Litvinenko. So he's quite a key guy in relations. It'd be interesting to do an interview with Pablo Miller, if he would like to do one, Martin.
Well, I think you should get on and chase him up, Tony.
You wouldn't talk to us, of course.
No, well, I mean, the thing is that MI6 has been an extremely dangerous organisation for many years.
He's an OBE, by the way, Pablo Miller.
I'm sure he is. Yes. NATO bombed Bologna railway station in 1980 and killed 87 people. The police in Italy know very well who did it. It's NATO intelligence services. They kidnapped the Prime Minister, Aldo Moro, and murdered him. Western intelligence services are terrorists. They supported all sorts of jihadis all over the world. I sent you some other stuff this week about a CIA officer, former CIA officer in Tel Aviv, talking on YouTube about how ISIS and Al-Qaeda were created and directed by Western intelligence and the Israelis. The Russians are very well aware of this. Al-Qaeda was created by MI6 in the 1980s and trained by our own special forces. The story is that they then went rogue. The Russians don't believe that, and they're right.
Now, a lot of this, I would say, has its origins in the fact that the NATO intelligence services got away with this thing called Operation Gladio in the 1980s, mainly. Do you want to just give us a quick... I'm going to have a quick listen to Gladio in Italy, a little clip from the Operation Gladio documentary. And I just find it amazing that if they think if they can get away with this sort of thing, we can do almost anything. And they did get away with it, but it's up to people like us and listeners, etc., to just keep doggedly going away at them, saying, look, you know, we know that you are a terrorist organization, NATO. We know you are MI6, and we're going to keep telling everyone all about it as much as we can until you stop.
Well, that's right. And of course, in the days of the internet, which we live in, nothing ever gets buried now. Anybody can put in a Gladio search on their phone right now, this minute, and it will all come up.
Well, it might not if you're going using Google.
Ah, well, there you are.
But you have to look for Operation Gladio, Time Watch, BBC. And I was very happy to report this a couple of months ago, that there's a really nice, crispy new copy of that, obviously from the archives, a proper one, rather than the one from Falmouth that we dug out in the 9/11 Truth movement. So let's just have a listen now to a little clip. Gives you an idea of what was really going on in Italy in the 1980s with massive bomb attacks, which was called the strategy of tension, because the idea was that the communists might be brought into the government, Martin.
That's right. Aldo Moro was on his way to invite the communists to join the government, but he never got there. And, of course, the police investigations by Imposimato, who was the head of the Supreme Court in Italy, who wrote a book, came out in 2012, La Repubblica dei Stragi Impuni, The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres, where it's all laid down because of results of police investigations that NATO intelligence services are and still are terrorists.
So this is using taxpayers' money to kill us and then point the finger abroad.
My daughter had gone on holiday with her boyfriend, and 5 days into their holiday, on the 2nd of August, they were killed in the Bologna train bombing explosion. And they managed to identify Catherine's body later on Monday, that she was horribly disfigured. They only recognised her by Miss Selfridge's blouse.
In 1980, a bomb exploded at Bologna railway station, which killed 86 people. 6 years later, an official report revealed the existence of an invisible government in Italy, run by the state secret services and groups of political terrorists. It also identified a secret military and civilian organization under which neo-fascist groups were allowed to commit atrocities against civilians for political motives. On May the 31st, 1972, the Carabinieri in Petiano received a phone call.
Senta, vorrei dirle che grave una macchina che ha due buchi sul parabrezza, no? Fra la strada de Pozzo Terfermata a Savogna.
Three policemen were lured to a car primed to explode. All three were to die.
De destra non si poteva e non si doveva attaccare lo Stato e chi lo Stato rappresentava.
So this was fascists killing police and members of the public in Italy, and the idea was let's blame it on the far left.
Well, the strategy of tension and the similar things went on in Turkey as well, and in other countries like Belgium. It's well worth people picking up this documentary. I'm sure there'll be a link on the show page for it, for people to watch it properly, because it's all very detailed stuff. But the thing is that all of this history is well known to those who know about it. And therefore, for example, in the Maidan Square in 2014, they shot down 80-plus demonstrators and police officers, a NATO-orchestrated death squad. And we know this because there was a court case in Kyiv where the Berkut riot police were exonerated. because they didn't shoot them, and the people who did do it confessed on video from Georgia that they had done
actually,
it.
Actually, the BBC did a bit of reporting on this, but a lot of this stuff has been buried.
That's
since,
right. So and people have got the idea, well, the Western intelligence services, they don't do things like that. And the fact is, the evidence going back decades
seems
is they do.
It's like the press is like the battleground where this is now being fought out. There's complete lies that we're going through these massive transmitter networks of billions of pounds. And there's people like us, and in fact, some other freelancers around the world are pointing this out.
Well, that's right.
And the Russians, of course, are pointing it out, but they've been banned.
Well, that's right. And, of course, if we can work it out using open sources, you can bet your bottom dollar that the FSB have been able to work all of this out. In fact, the
Russians, Chinese will
have
worked
it out. Yes, that's right. They'll have worked it all out. They know very well that Al-Qaeda and ISIS are front organisations for the Western intelligence services. The dogs in the street, no.
Well, we hear people like Steve Rosenberg on the BBC, who's their Russia correspondent, saying things like, oh, he's really disliked all around the world, Putin. Well, not so much in India. And here he is. I mean, we don't really hear much about this, do we? But here he is being interviewed in English by Indian TV, English language. I think it's called India Today, which is India's English language TV show.
You've always said that the eastward expansion of NATO is your real concern. Now, Ukraine hasn't got this NATO membership as of now. My question to you, sir, is NATO expansion the real threat or just a pretext for what you think is a part of Ukraine which is probably you want control over? Or you think that injustice is being done, Russian language is being banned, these were the real issues?
Послушайте.
Well, listen, NATO, well, it's a different topic entirely. Russian culture, Russian language, religion, and even territorial matters. These are all important matters, but these are one thing, whereas NATO is a different thing. And we're not demanding anything exclusive, anything unprecedented. There is a principle according to which the security of one country cannot be ensured at the expense of another country. This is a theory. Well, probably it's obtuse or abstruse, very difficult to understand, but I will explain that in simple terms. They say that any country, even including Ukraine, has the means to choose what means to employ to ensure their security, and we do not deny that right to Ukraine. But the thing is, this security should not be guaranteed at the expense of Russia's security. Ukraine thinks it better to join NATO, whereas we say that if that were the case, it would present a danger to our security. So let's search for a way that will ensure your security on the one hand, but on the other hand is not going to present a threat to us. Moreover, we're not insisting on anything, we're not demanding anything that would be unprecedented or wouldn't have roots in history. We are simply insisting on the promises that had been given to us should be observed. We didn't come up with that yesterday, you know. The thing is, this promise had been given to Russia, to the Soviet Union even, back in the 1990s, not an inch to the east. That is what they said. And after that, there has been several waves of NATO expansion, and right now, and then they came to trying to induct Ukraine into NATO. We're not simply disappointed with that or irritated because, you know, NATO is a military bloc. No, Article 4-5, I think, is still very much in place, the Washington Treaty, but no one wants to take our concerns into account. Moreover, when Ukraine gained its independence, very often it's forgotten, but one of the first documents that was adopted when independence was declared was the Declaration of Neutrality. And this is the basis for the current statehood of Ukraine, that is the Declaration of Sovereignty of Ukraine, which states that it's neutral.
Was that also the basis for what happened when you decided to annex Crimea, your only warm water port, a very important strategic port for Russia? And then Russia was no longer part of G8. Today, the West claims or says that your actions in the recent past is the reason for, and I quote unquote, the isolation of Russia.
Well, you know, we didn't have to get that important port because this port had already belonged to us, basically. Our navy, under treaty with Ukraine, had been stationed at this port in Sevastopol. These are just the facts. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, our navy was still stationed there. Of course, it was important. But, you know, the thing is, we didn't annex Crimea, and I would like to underline that. We simply came to help those people who didn't want their future to have anything to do with the people who orchestrated the coup d'etat in Kiev. These people in Crimea said, yes, these nationalists had conducted a coup d'etat in Kiev. Had we been consulted? Well, yes, we ended up, they said, as part of independent Ukraine after the collapse of the Soviet Union. These were just historical facts, very well. But we believe that it's a democratic state. And if a coup d'etat happens in a democratic state and the consequences of that coup unknown, we don't want to live like that. That's the reasoning of the people in Crimea. And there was a threat, not just of pressure, but also that Crimeans would be persecuted and Russia came to their assistance. And if someone thinks otherwise, thinks that Russia is gonna act in another fashion, then they are very much mistaken. We will always protect our interests.
So that's Vladimir Putin speaking in India. He's not being alienated there. They're quite happy to deal with the Russians and, you know, to trade with the Russians. Why aren't the Europeans?
Well, the only people who've put sanctions on Russia are the Europeans, the Japanese, the Canadians, the Australians, and the New Zealanders. Everywhere else in the world has simply refused to put sanctions on Russia, even when the Americans are now trying to bully people that they've got. See, Trump speaks out of both sides of his mouth. What Jeffrey Sachs pointed out is a lot of the way that the Western elites think is they're obsessed with game theory, whereas if we do this and this and this, we can make Putin's brain do that. That is not the way international politics really works. It's childish. It's pathetic. And it leads to all of the kind of problems that we've seen.
So would you like to, just finally as we round up talking about Ukraine, say exactly why it is? Do you think that the European powers are honest, as Oliver Tickell said at the start there, that they really think that they can bring about regime change in Russia and balkanise Russia?
They thought they could. They went to try. They've basically lost, but they don't know what to do next. And, of course, what's actually happened is that the collateral damage has been to the European economy. The US bombed the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Dogs in the street know that. What that does is it sabotages completely prosperity in Europe. The Russians are going to be all right. No doubt the wealthy in America are going to be all right. The people who are going to pay the price are young people in Germany, in Britain, in France.
So Narendra Modi and Vladimir Putin having a nice hug before talking about trade. In a way, the boycott of Russia is helping India, isn't it? Because maybe the trade will go via India now.
Well, that's what they were doing. I mean, the oil that goes to India is rebranded as Indian and then sold on to Europe.
With a bit more expensive. Okay, a little bit of a markup. Maybe that's what these things are all about. Maybe the Indians are behind the Ukraine war because they can make a bit of money at it.
The Indians are very... The Russian oil and gas that they get is very important for their economy. And in actual fact, they don't export that much to the United States. So if the United States tried to put sanctions on or tariffs on India to try and persuade them not to trade with Russia. So Trump is talking to Putin at the same time as trying to sabotage him so that Putin will be forced to talk to Trump. So it's a double, you know, it's a nice cop, nasty cop approach. But the ultimately, the Indians have been working with the Russians and the Soviet Union since World War II. A lot of they produce Russian tanks in India.
Isn't it that really what's
they
going
build
on
them
is,
in
the,
India.
Is the two sides in World War III are kind of shaping up?
Well, this is exactly what this is. It's World War III with the Western hegemony over the world trying to prevent...
Are the Western leaders really, and the Europeans particularly, really would rather have World War III than admit that they were wrong?
Yes, this is the kind of thing that happens, isn't it? If you look at the run-up to the First World War, everybody thought that they knew what to do and that they would be able to resolve it without a war, and then it turned out that they couldn't, and then they didn't know how to stop it. These things happen quite frequently in history.
So is it an accident?
Well, no,
it's not an accident, well, surely. I mean, but some people are pushing this, aren't they?
Yes, but all warfare is inherently unpredictable. Once you throw the dice,
it's a little bit accelerationist, isn't it? Oh, dear, crikey.
That's right, that's the whole point, isn't it? Ooh. And don't forget, driving this in the West is the money behind the arms industry. That what they're hoping they can do is create an arms industry in Western Europe, which will basically allow the wealthy to carry on owning shares in the companies that produce the weaponry, and they'll get a guaranteed sale to the government. They don't have to. You see, the Chinese are trying to develop new products at a reasonable price that people want to buy. They're actually market oriented. What we want to do is produce a load of military weaponry, which is no use anyway, because the Russians have obviously got much better kit and they've got a nationalised industry. But loads of money will flow into the pockets of many of the elites who have been behind this war. And they don't lose. The US didn't lose the Vietnam War in terms of the money that was put into the pockets of the people who supplied
the
weaponry.
I mean, the arms industry, again, is a total disaster here in Britain. We've just heard that this Ajax armoured fighting vehicle just doesn't work, and it actually injures the soldiers as they travel along in it, and it's been taken out of service. The Ajax is a British version of something called the Spanish ASCOD from the 1990s. It's a decent vehicle, but since the British got hold of it, it's been plagued with issues. CV90 would have had plenty of its own if they'd followed the same procurement pattern that they have with Ajax. Maybe not permanently injuring people, which I will concede, but every single bit of kit we field has endless issues. And this is someone on the Salisbury Plain Facebook page is mentioning the SA-80, the Eurofighter, the Merlin, the Milan, the PLCE, the F-35, the two aircraft carriers, Challenger 1 and 2, Bowman Radio and Sabre, are all been a disaster. And this is British military procurement. So we are paying loads of money for a load of kit, which it doesn't really work in the field.
And it doesn't matter, because the people making the money are making the money. If people are really interested in a discussion of military kit, I suggest going to Reminiscences of the Future, which is Andrei Martinov's blog. He used to be a Russian naval officer, and he's very, very knowledgeable about all this technical stuff.
Well, the problem is because the British apparently never buy kit off the shelf that's been proven. They just like to buy British stuff, which has not been proven. And the procurement process is a complete failure.
Well, the Russians have got nationalised arms industry, which isn't done for profit. That's how they defeated the Wehrmacht in World War II. The Germans had private industry supplying weaponry to their armies, and the private industry, at the end of the day, wasn't up to the job. You don't use the market to create an army. It's a stupid idea. You need to think about what the army wants.
And especially when your procurement process is a load of rubbish and you're not properly testing anything. So the new, apparently the British Army is acquiring a new assault rifle. There are two options, the Beretta and the Seiko, building assault rifle platforms. The HK416 is widely used and accepted as a decent, reliable assault rifle, mass produced and available immediately. The Colt Canada Dimaco C8 is revered by British Special Ops units and widely respected, available off the shelf. SIG MCX is available and widely proven and trusted. What do we do? Says this commenter. Buy the Knight's rifle for the Marines, which isn't as good as they first thought it was, and field two weapon systems for testing from makers who've never actually ever made an assault rifle before. So, it's British. Endless pits of wasted money and fallout.
Yes, but somebody is making money out of it, and that's the problem. It's actually functional from their point of view. But, of course, it's actually, in military terms, it's stupid. The Russians do allow some private sector contractors into their system, but they're very much, for niche products.
But the Russians don't do things like this at all, do they?
No, they make a plan about what they need to do, and obviously you want to keep the costs down.
Why do we want to go to war with some country that's actually really ready to fight us and win?
That's right. It's not just a question of whether we be in the right or wrong, or are we the baddies. You've also got to answer the question is, can you win? And the answer is absolutely not.
Well, as Oliver says in that longer interview, and by the way, I'll put the English language interview with Putin over in India up on our show page, the full version of that too, at thisweek.org.uk. As Oliver says, you know, I've got kids. I don't want them to go and fight Russia. This is insane.
That's right. Well, it's not just kids, is it? It's the whole thing has brought us closer to nuclear war than we've been since 1962. And most people still, I mean, we were talking about
climate change.
Actually,
in 1962, we weren't actually that close to nuclear war, even though a lot of people thought we were, because the whole fuss about Cuba was a climb down, basically, an organised climb down, because the West had put nuclear weapons in Turkey.
That's right. But of course, people used to worry about the danger of an accidental nuclear war.
NATO had done that, by the way.
Yes, that's right.
Ooh, NATO was pushing all the time. That's,
and also, of course, they overthrew the democratic elected government of Turkey using the military, using the mechanisms of Gladio. So there's they call it Ergonikon in Turkey.
Right, yeah.
So NATO is a war-mongering alliance run
quite
by
a lot of
profit.
Nazis. Quite a lot of SS people ended up at NATO, running NATO, etc.
That's right.
Funny, isn't it?
That's right. And of course, they've still, Martynov's very good at all of this stuff. They still fantasize about defeating Russia because that's what they would like to happen.
But are we really going to have a war with Russia, or is this just all
silly? It's already started. We're already at war with Russia. Let's face it, that's what's been going on for the last 4 years. But of course, it could escalate. At some point, it's quite possible, if we use our missiles, Storm Shadow missiles, to fire at US bases inside Russia...
The idea, it seems to me, is to eat away at Putin's patience.
They've got no idea how to remove him. They were hoping that the oligarchy would all get together and get rid of him, but Putin's neutered them. Yeah, they haven't got the power. And, of course, he's got massive popular support... 85% support, I've noticed last week.
Not like 10% for our...
No, that's right. And, of course, this is actually in very difficult circumstances. They've probably lost about 100,000 people fighting in this
war.
Seems
to me one of the big flies...
All of whom are mother's sons.
One of the big flies in the ointment here is Tampon Charlie, chit-chatting with the Germans about, we're going to have a war with the Russians. Of course, he's saying these sorts of things behind closed doors. He's not working for peace, is he?
No, and I would have thought somebody like in that position shouldn't be closing off the options of talking to the Russians by accusing Putin of being Hitler.
That's right.
We don't need that from you. Say nothing, even if you think that. You don't have to say it.
Well, that's what his mum would have done. Anyway, so like I say, the Putin chit-chat will be from the English language Indian television will be up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk. But we're going to go next door to Pakistan now, because it was a brilliant interview, I thought it was, on Sky News anyway, about Imran Khan and what's happening with him. What are they calling a military dictatorship? So I'll let Sky News take up the story.
Welcome back. We've been talking about former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan. He's said to be in physically good health, but he and his supporters point the finger of blame at the country's all-powerful army chief, Asim Munir. For years, the Pakistani military has maintained power behind the scenes. Now, through sweeping constitutional reforms, Asim Munir has moved to formally consolidate that power, placing the military in effective control of all three pillars of the state: the judiciary, the executive, and the armed forces. A new law has also been passed, granting immunity from criminal prosecution to the president and senior military figures. Well, I'm joined now by Ahmad Hassan Al-Arabi, an advisor to the Ministry of Information of Pakistan. Thank you, Mr. Al-Arabi, for joining us here on the program. Can I ask why Imran Khan has been refused his basic rights, which has included visitation from his family and access to his doctors?
Yes, Yalda, thank you so much for having me. Imran Khan, there's a process in Pakistan and it's in the world. It's called legal accountability. Imran Khan has been convicted on, not on political speeches. He has been convicted on criminal charges after investigations, prosecutions and court verdicts.
I'm not asking about his conviction, Mr. Al-Arabi. I'm asking about why the court orders have been defied. Even Pakistan's Human Rights Commission, an independent body, has said that regular access to relatives and legal counsel needs to be offered to Imran Khan. In fact, there was speculation that he was dead because he wasn't given any access by his family to him. So there was no proof of life at some point.
Now, Yalda, please allow me to finish. Imran Khan has been given access. The doctors have been given access to Imran Khan. There's the propaganda that PTI has been doing for the past two and a half years. It's in front of the entire world. Now, for the past 1.5 months, access was denied for the political gatherings. There's a very major reason behind it. PTI protests in the last 3 years, they were not just political gatherings. It was a coordinated violent assault on the state.
I'm not talking about the protests. I'm sorry. You're avoiding my question. My question to you is, why has he not been given access? Why haven't family members been able to access him? Why hasn't he been given legal counsel? Why did no one know whether he was alive or dead for at least 4 to 6 weeks?
You will have to let me finish, please. I'm answering your question. I'm trying to answer your question, but please allow me to finish. Imran Khan has always been an ardent supporter of Tehreek-e-Taliban Pakistan, TTP, a banned terrorist outfit. He has openly advocated for Al-Qaeda, called Osama bin Laden a hero.
So, currently, Mr. Al-Arabi, the question is, the question is not about the conviction. I'm asking you why he hasn't been given access to his family members. You're talking about him supporting Al-Qaeda. I'm simply asking you, not about the cases against him, but why he hasn't been given these basic rights. And if I can just quote the UN. The UN has said they are extremely concerned about the fact that he has been kept in solitary confinement.
Because Imran Khan has been given access. There have been 500 meetings of Imran Khan with his party leaders. There will be 189 meetings of Imran Khan with his family members. The thing is that Pakistan is facing a current surge in terrorism. There's a terrorist attack inside Islamabad, and Imran Khan's political party, Imran Khan, is an ardent supporter of that terrorist outfit.
Well, this interview does go on and on and on a bit more, and it gets more and more heated and more disagreements. But the point is that the Asim Munir, who's the army chief, sponsored by the United States, who's now a dictator, really, in Pakistan, has changed the constitution. So he now has complete control over the judiciary, the government and the armed forces, and he himself, plus his top army people, have all got immunity from prosecution.
Well, there's always been a power struggle going on in Pakistan between the military and the civilian, civilian political leadership. There have been elections in Pakistan, but they're largely rigged because the people that might have won were banned, so they weren't allowed to run. And, of course, the situation in the subcontinent is extremely tense and difficult. There's a potential war between Afghanistan and Pakistan and between Pakistan and India.
It's almost like an Assange-type figure, isn't he, Imran Khan, in a way? He's just been locked up in a high-security jail. He's not allowed to see his family. As she says, for several weeks they believed he was dead. They hadn't had any access to him at all. There's a UN is warning that a lifetime immunity for the military chief is just not acceptable. So there is, I mean, the interesting thing about Pakistan in terms of geopolitics is that they're a nuclear armed country, which is Muslim.
Yes, it's the Muslim bomb. They're the only ones who've got one. And, of course, they have, in fact, you know, the army who are running Pakistan have also suggested that they might, for example, give the, you know, nuclear support to Iran, for example.
Well, if the Americans are controlling... If the Americans are controlling all of this, as we suspect, well, we know they are, they're not going to want that, are they? They're not going to allow the Pakistani military to, say, for example, bomb Israel.
No, they're not. So, in other words, there's all of these tensions, you know, there's all sorts of things going on in Sudan, which we haven't covered. The world is on the brink of a major catastrophe.
But I'm talking about this particular thing with Pakistan. It seems obvious to me now that that Imran Khan, however, you know, bad or good he is, he cannot be allowed to do his job as prime minister there because of the Israelis, actually.
The Israelis are very keen to keep him in prison, you're right. The thing is that the Israelis have their finger in all sorts of pies far away from Israel. Yeah, they're working with the UAE to destabilise Sudan, for example. We just mentioned that. All of these conflicts are separate, but they're all interrelated. And, of course, the military...
It comes down, seems to me, more and more to this whole Pax Judaica thing. So the idea is that you've got an alliance of Zionists. I mean, actually, the Saker used to call it the Anglo-Zionist Empire, didn't he?
That's right.
And everyone else versus everyone else.
That's right. And, of course, the Israelis are playing to be the hegemon of the whole of the Middle East on behalf of their backers in the US and Britain. And you could say, well, who's really in charge in this relationship between the UK, the US and Israel? It doesn't really matter. Many people have actually got, you know, lots of Zionist billionaires have got Israeli, British and American citizenship. So we're dealing with one infrastructure here. And, of course, it's a very dangerous infrastructure. They've got a plan. They want to dominate. Then, of course, what's blocking them is all of the forces in the way, the Venezuelan revolutionary forces, the Palestinians, the Russians, and, of course, the Chinese, who are ultimately, you know, going to be the big arbiters.
Okay, we're going to finish now with a bit more David Livingstone. It's another section of the last interview I did with him. I find it's such a rich seam of material you get from him. And also, like I say, I will put a link up to various books. I think probably about 8 books I'm recommending for this year's. None of them mine, by the way. Although, of course, you can buy my books if you really want to for Christmas this year. One of them is David's book on Zionism, which is a really forensic look, although I might decide it's actually his Ordo Ab Chaos book, which is the best of the lot, which is, of course, the motto of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, Order from Chaos. And, of course, this is the people we're dealing with, the Lords of Chaos, the people that like seeding chaos around the world. But do you know anything about this guy, Boris Brassov, Martin? Have you come across him? He was a big figure in around the time of the First World War, an arms dealer.
No? It doesn't ring a bell.
Anyway, David talks about him here, and I can remember him popping up in that brilliant series, another wonderful thing. And if you really wanted to, if you've never seen it, watch it. It's called Riley, Ace of Spies. It's a sort of James Bond around the period of the First World War, and it's played by Sam Neill, Sidney Riley. But we're going to hear a little bit. He pops in, this guy, Boris Brassov, pops up in David Livingstone's little chat here about... some of the great writers. This is what we started talking about. Some of the very best writers that he's dug out over the years, talking about the occult and what's been really going on in history behind the scenes.
It's a satanic antichrist conspiracy. The first to use to adopt the swastika was Prince Charles of Hessen-Kassel. And so, again, this is a family. He was the heir of a family that were the principal supporters of Martin Luther and then the Rosicrucian movement. Their family, this is why it's so important that they trace their descent back to Philip I, Landgrave of Hesse, who, again, traced his descent back to the Night Swan that was popularized by Wagner, Hitler's favorite composer. His brother was the one who gave Amschel Bauer his start in his career, who later changed his name to Rothschild. He was also the He was the one who granted the, I think, the charter, if I remember, or basically he was the one who backed the founding of what's called the Frankfurt Juden Lodge, which was the first Jewish lodge to allow Jews to enter, from a Masonic lodge for Jews in Frankfurt. And basically that's really the network where you get the birth of all kinds of movements, because it was mostly joined by members of the Asiatic Brethren, who were all mostly followers of Jacob Frank, most of them disciples of Moses Mendelssohn, who was the father of modern Judaism, especially Judaism and ultimately Zionism. And so Prince Charles of Hesse-Kassel, he's the one who introduced the swastika from Indian tradition, Hindu tradition, Far Eastern tradition, maybe even Buddhist tradition, because he believed that it was a symbol to represent reincarnation, which was equivalent to the idea of Gilgul, the version of reincarnation found in the Kabbalah. And so the two symbols began to be used simultaneously, the swastika to represent the Gilgul of the Kabbalah, and the Star of David, which was a medieval magical symbol, also known as the Seal of Solomon, which was supposed to be the seal that Solomon used to control the jinn, the demons, in his practice of magic.
Yeah, looking at some of these traditions, I think it's fascinating. I mean, for example, with the Illuminati, you can see that the original helper of Adam Weishaupt, once he was uncovered as a conspirator and sacked from his job, I think it was at Ingolstadt University, it was the local Duke of Saxe-Gotha. Now, that's right. Funny, because that's the same family as the British royal family.
He was the grandfather of Prince Albert. Was it Prince Albert that she married, Queen Victoria? The husband of Queen Victoria.
Yeah.
So he was the grandfather of the husband of Queen Victoria.
Yeah, so it's a small, kind of tiny group of people behind a lot of this.
Yeah.
I think, you mentioned James Fraser earlier, and, he did such an amazing job with the Golden Bough, I think, to dig into a lot of these traditions. Someone else's, Margaret Murray, she wrote a book called The Witch Cult in Western Europe, which I think was absolutely devastatingly brilliant. No one was expecting her to write this, because she was actually an Egyptologist, but she started getting more and more interested in the Druidic traditions and witchcraft traditions in Europe and in Britain. And then she came out, I think, about 10 years off, maybe it was about 1930s, with another book called The God of the Witches, which looked very closely at evidence about from witchcraft trials. Obviously we know some of those witchcraft trials would have been vindictive, but there was also quite powerful evidence that was coming out.
It was a satanic tradition.
But many of the people were freely given confessions because they'd felt they were in a cult, and this was a way of kind of escaping the cult by turning king's evidence or queen's evidence or whatever. As there was a changeover in the traditions from the old Vatican Catholic tradition in England to and Scotland, obviously, and to the Protestant faith. And this was one of the things that had been festering for years, the problems with the Catholic protection of witchcraft cults on the Vatican. Sorry, not, I shouldn't say the Catholics. It was the Vatican that was doing this. Anyway, so we've got James Fraser, we've got Margaret Murray. Are there any other people who you think deserve like a big thumbs up and a bit of a medal for the massive, amazing work that they've done over the last century or so?
Oh, there's too many to mention. Some of them are not, they're not on our side, but of course there's Frances Yates. She really broke to the ground, I think. She's really the one, I think, who made the study of Western occultism respectable. She did an extraordinary study on the Rosicrucian movement. And Rosicrucian Enlightenment, but there's also several other books that she wrote. I think Gershom Scholem, too. Gershom Shalom, his scholarship was outstanding. But, you know, he was partial to the Sabbatian tradition. So he's biased, but still an extraordinary scholar.
And there is also, of course, this sort of knotty question of the Protocols of Zion, which were released, I think, by the Tsar's secret police not long before the Russian Revolution and the head chopping of the Tsar. So what do you make of that? Because this is quite controversial. It was used by Hitler quite a bit, wasn't it, the Protocols?
Absolutely. So this is a central theme in my books, because the person who published the Protocols first published them was a guy named Sergei Nilus, and he received them from a woman called Yuliana Glinka, and so she was a disciple of Elena Blavatsky. She's also worked for the Russian Secret Service, the Okhrana, in Paris. She was also part of a network, entire network that included people like Juliet Adams. And Juliet Adams, another disciple of Pappas. But they were also all friends with a guy named William T. Stead, who was a founding member of the Cecil Rhodes Roundtable. There's an excellent article, and it's in German, but I can't remember what this title, by Marcus Osterreiter, who's also he's also one of my favorite scholars, actually. And he's the first one who pointed out all these connections to me. And he basically suggests that what the Protocols were revealing was actually the plots of the Round Table. But so it's very mysterious. So when you look at the Protocols, they were also based, apparently they're a forgery of a book by Maurice Joly. But Maurice Joly was himself a member of the Memphis Mizraim Masonic Rite, and the head of that was Adolf Kremer, who basically was, you know, one of the early most influential Zionists. He was the Grand Master of the Memphis Mizraim. He was also one of the founders of the Alliance Israélite Universelle, which is, again, one of the most important early Zionist organizations. Sorry. And so it's all very mysterious how it came together. But what's most revealing is that they were disseminated by a guy named Boris Brassol. And he's a really, really, really mysterious character. He was basically a Russian triple agent. You know, Russians were at the time were conducting what they called Operation Trust. And that was to promote anti-communism, to sort of entrap potential dissidents. So he first exercised it. So apparently, according to one of his good friends, his collaborators, he was a crypto Jew. But then he ended up with a lot of other white Russian opponents of the Bolsheviks in Nazi Germany, and they founded a movement called the Aufbau. And the Aufbau included all kinds of people, especially two Thule Society members, which was Erich von Ludendorff and Alfred Rosenberg, who's, of course, the chief ideologue of the Nazi movement. And it's from him that the Nazis learned about the Protocols, and that Hitler eventually used it as his, what Norman Cohn referred to as, his warrant for genocide. So, you know, if you look at, so this is the pretext that Hitler used to carry out his war against all the poor Jews of the world, right? Like cobblers and shopkeepers, and while he is basically receiving money from people like the Warburgs and by the Rockefellers. But Boris Brassol then finds his way to the United States, and then he was referred to as, quote unquote, the brain trust of the America First Committee. So the reason why America First is so much in the news these days, it was, of course, first originally popularized by Trump, is because it's a revival of this concept that was originally a Klan slogan that was adopted by the America First Committee, which was basically a neo-Nazi front founded in the late 40s, in the 40s or late 30s, I guess, I can't remember what year exactly, but it was founded to lobby to keep the United States out of the war. And so out of the America First Committee, You get the American Security Council, which has been described as "quote unquote" heart of the American military industrial complex. The JFK, this is why JFK assassination is so central, because it was a plot that was carried out by Israel through a organization, a front called Permindex, which had all kinds of fascist links worldwide, and with a team of rogue agents of the CIA headed by a guy named Ted Shackley. Sometimes they're also known as Operation 40, in league with the Klan, in league with the John Birch Society. And this is really see how this underground fascist right in the United States really sort of began to coalesce and coordinate and start to build their influence and agenda. During the Vietnam War, they moved into the Far East and headed the Golden Triangle heroin trade. Then finally in the 80s, that evolved into Iran-Contra. And that's where you get this whole cabal of pro-Israeli neocons working with the fascist international, particularly groups like the Lupine Circle, all behind, again, the Iran-Contra operation. And then so it's that network, which is the backbone of an organization today in the United States called the Council for National Policy, also, or the CNP. And that's really where the base of Trump's support is derived from, and why he is currently the mouthpiece for this America First, effectively a neo-Nazi agenda. It's no accident that Elon Musk did a Nazi salute at the inauguration.
So that's David Livingston, final of the three clips we've had from that longer interview. It's about an hour and a quarter, I think. But anyway, he's there talking about the Protocols of Zion, which is a fascinating little document. Very difficult to know what its origin is. And it's funny enough, it's very much like this letter from Albert Pike, isn't it? The whole thing is supposed to be a complete fantasy and a forgery, etc. Only thing is, it actually describes what's going on, which is rather interesting. Whereabouts they came from is difficult to know, but I mean, if it describes exactly what's going on, obviously there needs to be a proper look at these things. And Dave here has pointed out as well, very similar with the report from Iron Mountain. Iron Mountain came out, I think, in the 1970s. It was again supposed to be a forgery, but it explains how you come up with something, because they were deciding at the time that there was going to be an end to the Cold War. Some people somewhere said, well, if we're going to have an end to the Cold War, we need to have another threat to humanity to replace it with. And Iron Mountain takes you through that and describes it. So there you go. The Protocols of Zion, Albert Pike, and Iron Mountain. There's three different types of a similar thing. So, also this week, and Martin may want to say something about this, we've also had a quite shocking and surprise bunch of raids and arrests on the European Union. Federica Mogherini has had to resign from something called the College of Europe after the Belgian police have raided them beginning of the week. She's had to resign from her role as head of the elite College of Europe after being indicted in a corruption investigation. The two others have also been indicted in this investigation into funding for school training of young diplomats. So this is a corruption scandal that's meant that the former foreign policy chief of the European Union is arrested and being questioned.
Well, obviously, I don't know directly what the allegations are, apart from what you've just said. Am I surprised? Well, no, not really. There's a lot of corruption around, isn't there?
And also, the European Union, I think the main problem is it's not... the European Commission is a weird thing, and even though we're supposed to see Mogherini as the foreign minister for Europe, there's no actual election for her.
Well, Kaja Kallas is the foreign spokesperson for Europe. She's Estonian. So this person must have been a previous one.
Yeah.
Okay, so there you are. Well, it's as you know, the structure of the EU is a vastly contentious, as you know.
Finally, one specially for you, Martin, Chrystia Freeland will move to Britain for a new job of Chief Executive of the Rhodes Trust Educational Charity. Now, can you just tell us who Friedland is and what this Rhodes Trust is?
Well, Friedland is a Canadian politician from the Liberal Party. She's got Ukrainian ancestry. Her grandfather was a pro-Nazi Ukrainian journalist. And so she's been very strongly pro-Ukraine. There's a big Ukrainian population in Canada who were all basically pro-German, and they were brought into Canada at the end of the war, because otherwise if they'd stayed in the Ukraine, they'd have been exposed to Soviet retaliation. The Rhodes scholarships are set up by Cecil Rhodes, and of course
the Roundtable group.
The Roundtable.
That David Livingstone was just talking about.
That's right.
About,
so in other words, it's the Anglo elite, the goal of the Rhodes scholarships. And you know, I used to go to the Rhodes library when I, because I had,
yes, books. I'd been there, yeah.
It's to you know, it's
mostly
to,
American books in,
yes,
there.
That's right. So in other words, it's to build an alliance between the elites in Britain and the United States in order to, you know, basically won the world.
I read a terrific book, or at least part of it, in that Rhodes Library, which was all about how the Rockefellers in the United States bought up all the public transport under a front company called National City Lines, and then ran it all down so that they could sell more oil to, and people would have to buy cars.
This stuff has been going on for a very long time. The elites are intermarried. Their children all go to the same schools, they all go to the same parties, they've always been running things, and they want, that's the way they want to continue it to be.
Yes, and when we don't. So anyway, it's a war on God, but God's going to win. Time to sign off. Thanks very much to our guest, Harriet Bradley, earlier on in the show. Also, of course, to Steve Headley and Oliver Tickell, but most of all to Martin Summers and to our sound engineer, Dave Bazanko. You can download this show as an MP3 from about 11 o'clock tonight and listen in the car or anywhere else you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews, story tips, etc., at the Tony Gosling Censored Telegram channel or on the show page. But best the Telegram channel these days. There's a lot of spam. Actually, you might try the show page, see how it gets on at thisweek.org.uk, where you'll get the podcast and all the full-length interviews, story links, and you've got a comment page there too. This week, oneword.org.uk. This show's repeated at 11 on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week. On the stream, do please make live recordings. We're streaming live now from Bristol, just about still, on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at djplugradio.co.uk in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, at holylandradio.com around about 2:30 up till that time, Central Time, at 87.7 FM in West Sweden, Wisconsin, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. Get available from GitHub and from the show page. If you can restream us or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the Bristol Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
I wonder if you could help me, please. I want to buy a gramophone.
A what?
A gramophone.
Gramophone.
A gramophone.
I don't think we've got any gramophones here, Grandad.
What's that?
That's a 3-hour automatic cut direct drive turntable, unless I'm very much mistaken.
What's the difference between that and a gramophone?
Well, about 30 years in a plastic cupboard, you chief.
Well, I'd like one of these, please.
You sure?
Yes, please.
All right.
This is going to be good.
Right, well, as you can see, it's got all the speeds. It's got 33 and 45.
Yes, what do I do with my old 78s?
What do you say?
Nothing.
You said, what about my old 78s, didn't you?
No, I didn't, honestly, no.
All right. So, you got your deck. Right. Do you want a Dolby with it?
Yes, please.
You only had Dolbys with tape recorders, Chief, all right? Do you want an amp?
No, I won't.
You won't hear anything, Grandad, without an amp, I'm afraid.
Oh, okay. Of course, yes, I want an amp.
Yes, an amp. Yes, all right, what sort of output are you looking for?
What sort have you got?
No clues.
About medium?
How many watts, exactly?
Well, I should think about three. No, 2,000. 500. 30. So you know all about it now, dear. You want a 30 watt amp?
A 30 watt amp.
Do you want speakers?
Yes.
Do you want rumble filters?
Yes.
Do you want a bag on your head?
Yes.
There we go, I'm going to bang on you. So you got your deck, you got your app, you got your rumble filters, and of course, you got your bag on your head. Now, do you want woofers and tweeters?
No, I don't want stupid things like woofers.
You've got them when you want them on, Grandad. They're in your speakers. You'll be telling us you don't want slimline salad dressing.
Yes, I do want slimline salad dressing.
Yeah. These things shall pass, and some great morning we'll look back and smile at heartaches we have known. So don't forget, when shadows gather, the Lord our God is still the King upon His throne. A rose looks gray at midnight, but the flame is just asleep, and steel is strong because it knew the hammer and white heat. These things shall pass and life be sweeter when love and faith are strong, they cannot long endure. These things shall pass, so don't you worry. The darkest time is just 1 hour before dawn. So hold up high and face your trouble, and don't despair if you must face them all alone. A rose looks gray at midnight, but the flame is just asleep, and steel is strong because it knew the hammer and white heat. These things shall pass and life be sweeter when love and faith are strong, they cannot long endure.
These things shall pass.
Of all the boys I've known, and I've known some, until I first met you I was lonesome. And when you came inside, dear, my heart grew light, and this old world seemed new to me. You're really swell, I have to admit you deserve expressions that really fit you. And so I've racked my brain hoping to explain all the things that you do to me. By mere Mr. Shane, please let me explain. By mere Mr. Shane means you're grand. By mere Mr. Shane, again I'll explain, it means you're the fairest in the land. I could say Bella, Bella, even Seven-der Bar, each language only helps me tell you how grand you are. I've tried to explain by mere Mr. Shane, so kiss me and say you understand. By mere Mr. Shane, you've heard it all before, but let me try to explain. By mere Mr. Shane means that you're grand. By mere Mr. Shane, it's such an old refrain, and yet I should explain, it means I am begging for your hand. I could say Bella, Bella, even Seven-der-Bar, each language only helps me tell you how grand you are. understand.